Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our speakers who've come from all over the country, and Vera came from Canada to be on our panel today about food addiction. I'll begin with Michael Prager. There's Michael. He was a daily newspaper journalist for 30 years, most recently for 14 years at the Boston Globe. He still writes for the Globe and other periodicals and maintains web presence at michaelprague.com and fatboythinman.com. Michael's book, Fat Boy Thin Man, chronicles his journey through a fat and troubled childhood that lasted 3 decades, where he reached 365 pounds, to his introduction to practices and treatments designed for addicts. He has now maintained 160-pound weight loss for almost 20 years. His book shares ideas that were shared with him. Dr. Nicole Avena received a PhD in psychology and neuroscience in 2006 from Princeton University. She then conducted postdoctoral research at Rockefeller University, studying molecular biology. She joined the University of Florida faculty in 2010 as an assistant professor. She also has an appointment at Princeton as a visiting assistant professor. Dr. Avena is generally interested in understanding the biological basis of motivating factors that lead some individuals to develop eating behaviors. Her work has largely focused on studying the concept of food addiction using animal models. She has applied and extended this work to the study of other nutrients, including fats. Other research interests include understanding the neural basis of eating disorders such as bulimia and anorexia. Dr. Avena has published over 40 peer-reviewed articles and has also authored several book chapters, reviews, and commentaries. She's presently editing a book on animal models of eating disorders. Dr. Eric Steis completed his PhD in clinical psychology at Arizona State University, an internship at the University of California, San Diego, and postdoctoral research fellowship at Stanford University in behavioral medicine. He's a senior research scientist at Oregon Research Institute. His program of research has primarily focused on elucidating factors that increase risk for onset of eating disorders and obesity, as well as the development and evaluation of prevention programs for these conditions. He uses brain imaging procedures, such as MRIs, to investigate initial vulnerability factors for obesity and drug abuse, as well as neuroplasticity changes in reward, attention, and inhibitory regions that emerge in response to overeating and using psychoactive drugs that may maintain these behaviors. He has published 166 articles in peer-reviewed journals, which have been cited by others over 6,600 times, 14 chapters, 6 books, and received 22 federal grants to support his research program. Dr. Robert Lustig, MD, is professor at pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology at UCSF. Dr. Lustig is a neuroendocrinologist with basic and clinical training relative to hypothalamic development, anatomy, and function. Dr. Lustig's research focuses on the regulation of energy balance by the central nervous system. He is currently investigating the contribution of nutritional, neural, hormonal, and genetic influences in the expression of current obesity epidemic both in children and adults. Dr. Lustig graduated from MIT in 1976, received his MD from Cornell University Medical College in 1980. He completed his pediatric residency at St. Louis Children's Hospital in 1983 and his clinical fellowship at UCSF in 1984. From there, he spent 6 years as a research associate in neuroendocrinology at the Rockefeller University. Dr. Lustig is the past chairman of Ad Hoc Obesity Task Force of the Pediatric Endocrine Society, a current member of the Obesity Task Force of the Endocrine Society, and a member of the Board of Directors of the American Heart Association of the Bay Area. He's the author of many articles, chapters, and reviews on childhood obesity, including the recent volume Obesity Before Birth. He is also the author of Fat Chance, Beating the Odds Against Sugar, Processed Foods, Obesity, and Disease, to be released in January 2013. Vera Igren-Tarman, MD, and many other initials, but I'm just going to stick with MD if that's all right. Thank you, Dr. Tarman, is an addiction specialist located in Toronto, Canada. She's the medical director of Renaissance Canada's largest drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. She also works as staff consultant for the Homestead, a Salvation Army women's residential treatment center for drugs and alcohol. She has worked in the field of addictions for the past 19 years and has drawn clinical parallels between the addictive behavior of addicts and alcoholics and people suffering from food or eating abnormalities. Dr. Tarman has presented at international public forums on the subject of food addiction and has produced an educational DVD. We have several copies there, as Michael's books as well. On the subject. Dr. Tarman has also appeared in the media numerous times to promote the concept of food addiction with the goal to encourage treatment that is designated for food addiction specifically. She is part of a working group of professionals to design an educational curriculum for food addiction counselors. Dr. Tarman has created a website presence to keep followers aware of topical issues of food addiction, addictionsunplugged.com. She has published one book and is currently writing a book on food addiction that will synthesize the science and her clinical experience of food addicts. Dr. Alyssa Appel is an associate professor at UCSF Department of Psychiatry. She is also a faculty member in the Health Psychology Postdoctoral Program, the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, the Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Postdoctoral Scholars Program, one of the founders and director of research at the UCSF Center on Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment, that's COAST. I will give you the website. It's too long. I'll give you the website later. She received a BA in psychology from Stanford University, a PhD in clinical psychology from Yale University with a focus on health psychology. Through her research on stress and training in the Yale Center for Eating and Weight Disorders, she became interested in the intricate relationships between chronic psychological stress, eating behavior, and energy balance. She completed a clinical internship focusing on behavioral medicine at the Veterans Affairs Palo Alto Healthcare System. She has a longstanding interest in social and psychobiological stress mechanisms and impact of stress physiology on food intake, insulin resistance, obesity, and premature aging at the cellular level. Her focus is on psychoneuroendocrine mediation, how stress-induced hormonal dysregulation may mediate relationships between stressor appraisal and metabolically related outcomes, food ingestion, insulin resistance, visceral fat distribution, and cell aging. Her primary study is on family caregivers and attempts to understand from a psychobiological and genetic perspective why some people are vulnerable and others are resilient to the chronic stress of caregiving. Thank you all for being here. I'm going to clap. before we begin our program, in about an hour, or when this first section is done, we'll have a 10-minute break to stretch and use the facilities, and then we'll have another one so you can plan. We'll have two short breaks, 10, 15 minutes tops, and you have the questionnaires on your chairs right now. We're doing Q&A at the end. So as you go through, if you think of your questions, write them down so you remember at the end. And then Dr. Bill Grant, who's the chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum, will be at the microphone making sure you ask one question and not six, which generally can happen. So, all right. So here we go. Excuse me. So, Dr. Lustig, for a substance to qualify as addictive in the medical profession, it must meet certain criteria. What are the criteria to be considered a food addict?
Let me start out by a quick disclaimer. I'm actually subbing today for my colleague, Dr. Andrea Garber, who was supposed to be here in my place. She had a family emergency and asked me to cover. I am on call at the hospital and have to round later this afternoon, and so I will probably be leaving slightly early, maybe about 2:30. So if there are questions specifically for me. At one of the breaks, that would be probably a good time. And I apologize for Dr. Garber not being here. She was the first author of the paper that we just wrote called Is Fast Food Addictive in Dr. Avina's volume, Current Drug Abuse Reviews, and she would have been a wonderful person to have here, but I will do my best in her place. So the question actually is, what's the criteria for a substance to qualify as addictive, and then what are the criteria for a to qualify a person as a food addict, and those are two different issues at once. So let me try to deal with both of them. In terms of the substance, there are various phenomena that go on, which everyone here is very better aware of than I am, since I actually don't research addiction per se. I've just read about it, and I take care of patients with food addiction. But those specifics are substances that induce changes in the brain that you'll hear a lot about in a few minutes, having to do with changes in dopamine neurotransmission, changes in opioid neurotransmission, changes in acetylcholine neurotransmission, specifically within an area of the brain called the reward center, in technical terms, the nucleus accumbens. And there'll be quite a bit of information that you'll hear from both Dr. Zavina and Dr. Stice as well on this phenomenon and what goes on. The concept of addiction is because of changes in how that reward center perceives those neurotransmitters. There are specific components of our food supply that do these changes. In particular, as you'll hear, sugar, which is my particular interest, and also caffeine. There are other substances that may have other salience effects on those systems as well. To be considered a food addict, based on the Diagnostic Statistical Manual number 4, which is the one we're currently operating off of, there you have to satisfy three of the following 7 criteria. Number 1, tolerance. So that means more doesn't give you the same level of effect. That's tolerance. Withdrawal. If you take the substance away, you have physiological symptoms because of the removal. Binging, that is, you go seeking it and overuse whatever substance it is. A desire and attempts to quit. Craving and seeking. Interference with quality of life. And finally, use despite knowledge of negative consequences. So if you have any three of those 7 based on DSM-4, you would be described as a food addict. Now, DSM-5, which will be coming in shortly, has a slightly different view of this. There are 2 physiologic criteria that you have to meet. That is tolerance and withdrawal, and those are specific physiologic criteria having to do with these changes in dopamine that we were talking about. And then a host of other psychological dependency questions, some of which are very similar. So it depends on who you talk to as to whether someone's a food addict or not. And, of course, there are plenty of people who don't even believe in it. We're hopefully here to dispel that notion.
Thank you. Dr. Stice, why would you theorize that food is addictive, and is there a genetic component?
Basically, our brains have only one, reward pathway. I'm going to use colloquial terms. And so anything that makes us feel good is going to operate through that same neural pathway, whether that's food that releases dopamine in that neural, the reward regions, or drugs or alcohol that do the same thing. So that's why I think anything that causes your brain to release dopamine, increase dopamine signaling, is going to operate through the same pathways, and there would be similarities between addiction to drugs and alcohol and to palatable foods. The genetic component, we're still unraveling this, but it seems that a cohort of polymorphisms that influence the signaling capacity of the dopamine neurotransmitters, such as a TACA1 allele, the more the more polymorphisms you have that are associated with compromised dopamine signaling, which is ironic, the more your addiction potential. So that seems to be one of the genetic components that would be related to food addiction. Almost for sure there's others. But I did want to sort of take this moment to sort of point out that there are profound individual differences, that if you give your kid a chocolate milkshake, they're probably not going to become a food addict, in the same way that most people who try cigarettes never become addicted to cigarettes. So there's an interaction between an obesogenic environment like we live in right now and individual differences that predispose individuals to overdo things that release dopamine, and that's the risk factors for overeating and for drugs and alcohol use are very similar.
Thank you. Dr. Tarman, Please explain the new definition of addiction from the American Society of Addiction Medicine.
I'm a clinician and I work in the field of addictions. And prior to this new definition, we've been working with the DSM-4, which is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of mental disorders. And our understanding of substance has always been very much focused on the substance, whether it's alcohol or cocaine or tobacco, and food has not been on that list. And Dr. Lustig very nicely defined what some of those characteristics are. In the last 6 months or so, the American Society of Addiction Medicine finally got it sort of made it an official diagnosis to say, or an official term to say, let's stop looking at the substances, but let's start looking at the brain itself, which is what we're all intuitively talking about anyway, but it's not been in the literature that way. And as a result, food has not been able to get on the list. And the new definition is, it's a really exciting change for people in the field who are actually working in the field looking for treatment. And the sort of overall concept of it is that it's saying addiction is a primary, progressive, primary meaning it's a brain issue, it's not just environmental, chronic progressive disease of the reward circuitry. And just to make it really simple, they have the ABCs. If you're unable to abstain from your substance or behavior, so it doesn't have to be a specific food, it can be the way that you're eating as well. And if you can't abstain, that's the number one. B, if you can't... if you can't control your behavior or your item, i.e., how many people can only have one chip or one cookie? Well, if you can, then you're not a food addict. But if you can't, that's an indication that maybe you're going to be on the list. Third one, C, cravings. Do you have cravings? Do you have obsessions? Do you think about it in the morning, in the middle of the day, at night when you should be thinking about other things? D, do you diminish your emotional response to it? Like, oh, that was... So what if I just gained 50 pounds? It's not that bad. I don't look that bad. Or so what if I've got a bit of diabetes? It's not insulin-dependent diabetes. You kind of diminish your response. In the same way that the alcoholic will say, it's only been two DUIs. Come on. It's not that bad. And then finally, emotional instability, either around the food or just in general, because most of us who use food as a mood moderator will find that when they're using food as a mood moderator, it moderates food. So you go up and you go down and you have the ups and downs, which we in the clinical field will diagnose as anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, when in fact it couldn't be a direct result of the food addiction. So having that new definition opens up the possibility that food can actually get thrown into this compendium of other addictions.
Thank you. Dr. Avina, your research has been on animal models and measuring dopamine and other neurotransmitters in the receptors in food addiction models. Would you summarize your findings, please, and also explain what dopamine is?
Sure. So I should start by saying that a lot of the things we're talking about today with regard to food addiction, these are somewhat colloquial ideas that have been around for a while. People have been talking about food addiction. It's been something that the public's been talking about and acknowledging it, just as that the scientists have kind of taken a while to catch up. And it's really only recently, I'd say within the past 10 years or so, that we've started to see some actual empirical data and some organized studies that have been conducted to show whether or not food can actually be addictive. And so my role in that has been looking at the animal models of food addiction. And so in our lab, what we've done is to study this, we've developed models in which we offer rats sugars or high-fat foods to consume. It's a voluntary consumption. They don't have to eat them if they don't want to. And what we find is that if we offer these animals these highly palatable foods to eat, they come to develop a series of behaviors and, more importantly, changes in the brain that resemble an addiction-like state. And so we'll see that animals that are overeating sugars, for instance, will show many of the criteria that Dr. Lustig described that are used to consider a criteria as being one that a substance of dependence. And so our rats will overeat sugar. They'll binge on it. They'll show signs of tolerance. If we take the sugar away, they'll show signs of opiate withdrawal. So when we simply remove the sugar, we can see that these animals will show signs of anxiety and distress and physiological changes that look like what an animal who is in a withdrawal from morphine would show. They also show a heightened propensity to consume other drugs of abuse. So simply having a history of overeating is changing these animals' brains in a way that's now making them primed to consume alcohol or to consume other drugs of abuse, which is interesting because it suggests that there's some underlying commonalities in the neural circuitry that's being perturbed by both overeating palatable foods and drugs of abuse. We further got on to look at these behaviors by seeing, well, what's happening in the brain. And so what we've done is look at a variety of different neurotransmitters that are associated with drug addiction, but we've been looking at them within the context of animals that are just overeating highly palatable foods. One of the neurotransmitters that Patty mentioned is dopamine. Dopamine is important for a variety of reasons. It's been thought about within the context of addiction as being associated with not only the novelty of the addictive substance, but also as part of the reinforcement associated with addiction. So when someone's addicted to a drug of abuse, dopamine is involved. In the nucleus accumbens or the ventral striatum, a region of the reward circuitry, dopamine plays a critical role. And so when an animal takes a drug of abuse, when a person takes a drug of abuse, it releases dopamine that's associated with the high. What we find in our animal studies is that if we give our animals sugars or fats to overeat, they'll release dopamine every time they get access to them. And so this is interesting because this is not like what we would expect to see with access to food. We don't normally see this repeated release of dopamine, but it is like what we would see if an animal was dependent on a drug of abuse. So we're seeing parallels both behaviorally and neurochemically in terms of what's happening when the animals are overeating food and how they resemble addiction-like states. We also see, you know, a variety of different changes in their, you know, gene expression of these different neurotransmitters and the expression of the receptors that go along with the idea that there are alterations in both dopamine systems and also the opioid systems in the brains of these animals that are similar to what you would see if they happened to be addicted to a drug of abuse.
Dr. Appel, is there a connection between our brain chemistry, stress, and food addiction?
Yes. So there is an important link between stress and compulsive eating. And we can see this link in behavior and in the brain and how the brain is wired. So behaviorally, some people, when they're under stress, feel strong, compulsive, and irresistible drives to eat. And, of course, not any food, to eat highly palatable food. And, of course, the other people might lose their appetite. So there are certainly these individual differences we come with our biological temperaments and how we respond to the eating environment. So typically, if we're under a severe, coping with some severe stress right in the moment, digestion shuts down, we don't have hunger. But that's a short-lived response. Most of life we live in recovery from stress, or we kind of take stress with us in our thoughts. And that's the more low-level stress that we deal with that we think is really tied to the obesity epidemic. So we did a study recently published. We just asked over 400 Bay Area women about two things. We asked them how much stress they had in their life, and then separately we asked them about what they eat and different eating styles, how much they feel like they can't control their eating, and what strategies they use to stop eating. And for stress, we measured both how stressed they feel and then a more objective measure. We cataloged all the different situations in their life that they're coping with. So we call that kind of objective chronic stress exposure. And what we found was it didn't matter what type of stress we were measuring, objective or subjective, there was this gradient where the more stressed the women were, the stronger their drive to eat, the more they did binging, the more they felt like they didn't have control over their eating behavior, and the more they ate junk food, snack foods. So there's this link between stress and this kind of drive to eat. Now, is that food addiction? It's not addiction. It's on a continuum. Maybe some of those women at the extreme ends had true addiction, but we're really talking about this common neural circuitry that motivates behavior in daily life that is basically influencing our eating and our weight. And stress is absolutely tied into that, intertwined. The same neural networks that control the stress response control energy metabolism. So it's no mystery that this neural network of stress, it's just a subset of energy balance. So the story gets worse than this. How do we control our eating? How do we keep normal weight? One of the most important functions is the stop button or the break on eating. And so when we look at that break, we all control our eating in different ways, and we can measure good restraint and bad restraint. Good restraint is when we're noticing and aware of how much we're eating and monitoring and also planning ahead. So if we eat too much one meal, we eat less the next meal. Bad restraint is inflexible or rigid restraint that comes with strict dieting. And that is the type of restraint where you have simple rules like I won't eat breakfast, so there's periods of famine and then feasting because no one can go for too long without the calories, their brain will rebel. And there's strict rules like forbidden foods that are if you break a rule, you might overeat. So there's types of rigid dieting that we think are maladaptive and lead to overeating. So in these just community women from our area, we looked at the type of dieting they did. And the more stressed they were, the more the maladaptive dieting and the less of the adaptive or good dieting they were able to do. So it affects our ability to control our behavior and plan ahead and stop impulses. Stress is directly affecting those direct brain mechanisms. And I'll talk a little bit later about how stress is changing our brain and is linked to addiction per se. And just as a simple finding that demonstrates the connection, when we're stressed, that alarm hormone in the brain, CRF, is directly projecting and affecting dopamine in this reward area.
Mr. Prager, your book, Fat Boy, Thin Man, chronicles your own path of food addiction. What makes you think you're a food addict when its very existence is not accepted by mainstream?
Hi, everyone. I'm glad to be here. I'd like to point out the obvious. Patty just called me Mr. Prager. I'm the one up here who is not a PhD or MD. The letters after my name are M-E, as in just me. I self-identify as a food addict. Before age 33, I had lost and gained hundreds of pounds. As you can figure out quite quickly, unless I came out of the womb at 700 pounds, it's because I kept gaining it and losing it. I was a champion dieter. I lost more than 130 pounds twice. I had been on diets since I was 10 years old. And yet, on October 21st, 1991, when I went into a rehab facility in the eating disorders unit, I weighed 365 pounds. By becoming open to the idea that I might be a food addict, that my problems might be more than low moral fiber or laziness, that I might have a larger problem, then I started to get better. So that's my first answer. I actually have four answers to this question. The first answer is that whether food addiction exists or not, when I started acting like I was an addict and taking the treatments, taking on the practices and attitudes that other addicts, real addicts, had been using for decades, I got better and my life was transformed. So whether it's real or not, I don't care. The treatments were effective in transforming my life. One of the problems with that is that until someone thinks they have a severe problem that needs intense attention, as opposed to, oh, I just need to knock off Twinkies for a while, they won't undertake the more robust set of solutions that there are. I wouldn't. I wasn't happy to find out that I might be an addict. It wasn't good news, and I didn't take to it. But I didn't reject it entirely, and I started making changes based on this thought, and my life started to change. I heard lots of definitions of what addiction looks like, the seven criteria in the DSM, or the four or five that Dr. Tarman mentioned in the ASAM definition, and I relate to all of them. The question is, increasing tolerance. Well, I didn't. I would often eat a couple of subs and a couple bags of chips at a sitting. Explaining to the clerk that I was, I was getting it for the gang, but they were all for me, and. I didn't always eat that way, but there came a time when eating X amount wasn't enough. And so I would get X plus one, and that the amount that I ate increased over time. That's increasing tolerance. I needed more substance to get the same hit. So I can relate to a lot, you know, unintended consequences of going, you know, deciding I'm just going to have one, and ending up eating an awful lot more than one. That wasn't my intention. If I was, you know, rational, I wouldn't have eaten that way. I decided I wasn't going to eat that way, and then I ended up doing it anyway. The last answer I have for what makes me think I'm an addict is that I used to abuse cocaine. And everyone agrees cocaine is a real addictive drug, right? Well, I was doing it enough that I actually had a boss come to me and say, when you started working here, you were the sharpest guy on the desk, and now you're the one most likely to make an error. I don't know what's going on, but you better fix it. And that was because I was doing too much cocaine before coming to work. I worked at 4 in the morning, so I'd do cocaine at night and then go to sleep for half an hour, and then show up at work and not be at my best. Imagine that. I finally came to see that I could have a pile of cocaine the size of this room. I would stay up for weeks. I wouldn't go to work. I would eat, which is not consistent with many other cocaine addicts. I was always bitter about that. I couldn't, you know. But I would stay up, and I would do that cocaine until it was done. And when it was gone, I'd be crawling around on the floor looking for that last little bit that I had missed. And when I saw that there was no satisfaction, I thought, well, that's crazy. It's costing me money. It's affecting my work life. It's affecting my social life. I ought to just quit. And I did. I have also had the same experience with food literally, and I mean this, hundreds of times, if not thousands of times, waking up in the morning, still burping up the taste of whatever I ate last night because I was so stuffing myself, and thinking, oh, that was awful. I spent all that money. I stayed up all night. I'm tired. I'm in I'm the food equivalent of hungover. I should stop that. I might as well quit. I had that thought, and I couldn't until I started going to rehab and going to support groups and getting therapy and doing the things that other addicts had done for, as I said, for decades, that I was able to make changes that I wasn't able to make by myself. And so those are some of the ways in which I am sure that I'm an addict and that the treatments for addicts are what are saving my life. Thanks.
Thank you. Just, Alyssa, Dr. Appel, you mentioned energy balance. I believe you mentioned energy balance. Just so you can explain if someone doesn't realize what you mean by energy balance, could you explain that particular phrase?
I'm eating more calories than you're burning.
Okay,
so
there
positive
you go.
Energy balance.
Just in case, energy, you know, what is energy after all? Right. And I had another, as I was listening to you, Michael, it's, Dr. Avina, I believe I read in one of your studies that when given the choice between cocaine and sugar, your little mice or rats or whatever they were went to the sugar before the cocaine?
Yeah, that wasn't my study, but it was a colleague's study. Serge Ahmed did that study. And yeah, so there's been some studies that will suggest that animals, when given the choice of if they prefer sugar or saccharin over mm-hmm. cocaine, that there are animals will more likely go towards sugar.
Oh, I didn't read the saccharin part. If they had a choice between saccharin and sugar, which would they do?
Yeah, it seems the sweet taste is what's driving mm-hmm. a lot of the effects.
Is there a preference between sugar and saccharin?
I don't know if that study has quite been done to compare the sucrose versus saccharin. But yeah, Eric's saying he thinks it was saccharin.
Okay, yeah. Interesting. Now, we have the next part of our talk. We're going to get into more specifics in depth. We can begin that because I think I've scared them all into not talking too long, so they were very succinct. So would you like to take just a 10-minute break now and then get back into the thick of it, or would you like to – yes, I'm seeing yes, a quick – okay, we'll do a 10-minute quick break here, but I'm asking it at the break, please don't ask questions, if you don't mind, of the panelists at this point, because I'm sure if you have a question, somebody else has the same question. We'll do all those at the end where everybody can hear the answers. So come back at 9:45, right? Yeah. Well, that was my point right there. That's what I just said. I think that I scared them all into.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Well, I want to get through that quickly. I do that on purpose, actually.
He wasn't.
No,
sure.
Right.
Oh, yeah. We've got to. I'm sure you'll have more on the back side of that sheet. Yes. Oh, yes.
He was the one who said, oh, yes, this is our
trying
assessment. Right. Which surprised me because I had sort of thought it was.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
You can tell.
Yeah. Definitely
ahead of schedule.
Yes, especially when she said,
hey, yes.
Oh, yes.
Hi. I'm glad to see you here.
She also said,
same here.
Yes.
I know, and that there's good restraint and bad restraint.
Oh, good. Yes, I've been following your work. Yes, I know we've been seeing quite a few murals over the years, so it's nice to finally put a face or actual image.
It would be considered bad restraint in some people, for sure. But it's essential restraints. I don't care. I don't care what it's called.
Right. You know, the ADA and the RD refrain is there is no such thing as a bad choice. Everything in moderation. That's by people who don't understand.
Yeah.
There are some substances that people should abstain from.
Exactly. Totally.
So I'm real curious what you guys are going to say in terms of what you recommend to your family.
Right. Well, also, there is a part of the
program where we're
talking about treatment, so, well, you'll have to write a third book.
I'm glad they are. I'm more interested. Thank you.
In fact, if you'd like to look at an advanced copy,
please send it to me. Or do you have a PDF?
I have a PDF.
Okay, sure.
We met in Seattle, I think, at the food farm. That was a great meeting.
What I see, grand scale in my practice. So many addicts who substitute. We went from cocaine to food, or probably food was there first.
Yes.
It's over my bag.
You may mention it to... She said that we're ahead of schedule. There'll be more room than we need.
Sure.
This is Dr. Vera Inwood-Turner. This is Connie Bennett.
Yeah, Alyssa and I have been talking a bit about this for years.
So I will be interested. If you would like to take a look, this week, believe it or not, wrapping up my last chapters, you'd like to take a peek.
Sure, send me a PDF too.
Okay. Great. Okay.
Let me give you my send a copy to me. That'd be great.
Okay.
You know, I'm interested in just a bit more about this. I don't want to talk too much about it because none of it's published yet. But I'm interested in so some of these are ways in which we can set our lives more eating. And so I think it's important to sort of look at stress components and looking at the cortisol levels and arousal and sort of bring that in. So I'll be following up on this type of work. So it'd be good to stay in touch.
Okay.
I forget your name. Jennifer, nice to meet you again. Yeah? I saw you in Davis, right? And at Bainbridge, or was it Bainbridge? When did I meet you? So you work with Alyssa, right? Okay. That's right. Yeah, that was such a cool meeting. We were just saying how we should really try to do something like that again, because it was so, I don't know, it was like the first time I actually really heard the real experience of what it's like to be a food addict. And it's so interesting because in the book, he's like, oh, none of the scientists had ever known a food addict. People don't volunteer this information. So, like...
Well, I was thinking that this is, you know, food addict and I just had the idea of...
Yeah. Do you think you would?
I'm not.
Yeah, I don't know if that's considered acceptable. Like, if they would be bothered by that.
One time, I feel...
I'm sure they'd support the mission, that you would be more educated about it. But yeah, no, we talked to all sorts of people that were just admitting to doing behaviors that I would have never imagined people did.
Or in your research studies.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting because we do, you know, since I study eating disorders, we always do diagnostic interviews about eating, and it is crazy, the stuff that people in our obesity treatment trials, I mean, they're just like run-of-the-mill looking college students that will like go 3 days without eating or just do really insane things and, you know, eat horrible. I mean, like, I can have a gallon of ice cream with 4 Snicker bars cut up on top. It's like, you eat the whole thing in one city? Like, how do you do that? You're not that big. So it's really, I think, good to have that objective sort of reports of what's really going on. Or I guess it's not objective, it's more truthful. But yeah, well, if you make it, I know that Michael is going to try to find a FO meeting. Or whatever, screw that, FA meeting? I forget what he said. Anyway, he was going to try to find those meetings today. He was going to go try to find them. So you might ask him if you could accompany him. Because that would be probably an easy way. And then you could say, this is my friend who's not a food addict. Because you're supposed to go around and do that. Like, my name is Michael. I'm a... So I don't know if you'd fake it or what. Should be careful about what we're discussing on microphones, I suppose. But well, are you at SF still? And you were sort of starting a postdoc when I first met you. Okay, and so is that done? Yeah. Huh? Yeah. Well, the K Award is such a good mechanism. It's really, I mean, it's the best thing to start a career with. Okay. Now, you weren't working with, who's it? Yeah, are you? Okay. Oh. Yeah. Well, it's sort of interesting because do you think that by increasing the amount you're focusing on the reward could have bad effects? No, they do that to themselves. They start with more reward. If you look at at-risk kids, once they overeat, they dampen down the reward system. Yeah.
Come on back in.
We just had a really nice paper come out in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition that says basically how frequently you eat ice cream totally affects how much your reward circuit is activated to ice cream-based milkshake. Like, it's a crazy big effect. But I think that's because they're down-regulating the reward circuitry just like a Coke addict would. Yeah. And being slower, so you get all the gut peptides acting still. So.
All right, everyone, come on back in.
Mm-hmm. We'll do. Yeah, I think that's it's a fantastic idea. Question to answer well.
Do you have a quick question for Rob before
we
get
could
next
look
break?
At okay. Truly, what's how much the attention network is activated as they eat? And, because we're finding big attentional effects, but. We're working on cognitive reappraisals that will undo that hyper-attention to food cues and increase inhibitory control. And it's basically that the eating disorder people string me up. But it's I think it's a good treatment for obesity. But we should talk.
Okay.
I am forever available for that work. I consider it important.
It's also...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Alyssa?
She went off for something to eat.
Twinkies. Twinkies.
She said she'll be
back. It's okay.
There's plenty to talk about.
Yeah, there is.
Yes.
There's plenty to talk about.
They were just saying Alyssa went after a pizza.
Oh, I meant to get more water.
Oh. Well, I don't know. Maybe she did.
Although I wouldn't mind another
slice of it?
No, I wouldn't mind another addictive substance up here and coffee.
Here she comes.
Oh, here she comes. There you are.
Yeah, we could probably walk down to Pete's the next break.
Right, exactly. That's what I need. Everybody's got their addiction.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
So, Alyssa, we're just going to... Yeah. Just down and just down.
Talk more.
Yes,
talk
more. Okay. Yes, we can
move some up. I hardly ever get asked to talk more.
Talk more.
Okay, well, thank you all. That was, you guys just made good time there. Before we go on to the next part, which is more specifics, Dr. Tarman would like to expand a little bit or has some comments on everything that Michael, sorry, I have to not call her, but Mr. Prager. Dr. Tarman.
Thank you. It's really wonderful to be here up in San Francisco and be representing this topic. I have a real passion for this topic because I work in the field of addiction, and I've been in this field, as I said, for about 19 years. And what Michael explained as, you know, an individual food addict is what I see. I see probably about 1,000 patients, I think I figured out a year, new patients that I do intakes on. And I see the pattern repeated, what Michael said, on a continual basis. It's to me, where I see it so much, it's like a no-brainer. How can we not see this as an addiction? I see people who have come in as an alcoholic or come in as a cocaine addict, and then they've stopped their substance because they're in a controlled environment. They're there for 28 days or however long it is. And because there isn't a food addiction paradigm that's accepted, what are they fed? But starches and sugars and fats. They say to me, I can't understand. Why am I eating 5 chocolate bars a day? Why am I eating all the cookies that Millie has made, in the diner? And then they say, I gained 30 pounds in this 28 days. Why? And to me, it's like, well, are you eating it in the same way that you did your cocaine or your alcohol? And they say, yeah. I see them in 6 months or in 9 months sometimes. Often when they've come back because of a relapse. And what will they say to me is, you know what, I gained 40 pounds and I would rather go back to my crack use. I'd rather drink again. Mm-hmm. It's called the Jenny Crack Diet. I would rather find a way to figure out, because the addict always thinks that they can figure out how to manage their substance, rather than figure out how to manage food, which is so hard in our society where the cues are everywhere. And not only are they everywhere, but they're supported everywhere. They're supported even in the treatment facilities themselves. I just wanted to say that. And just to add on to that, I think that it's a primary reason why we see relapse in addiction. A person comes back, so I've just said the crack addict says, I'd rather go back to using crack. But the alcoholic might say, well, I'm sober, but I'm not happy. I'm still not happy. I've been sober for 5 years, and yuck. And I want to say to them, what are you eating? Could it be that if you're eating in the same way that you were drinking, that your mood is still being fluctuated in such a way that you're not really sober, even though you're sober of that one substance, you're not sober of a substance, and so that your mood dysregulation is pretty much the same as it was when you were drinking. I just wanted to add on to
that. Thank you. Did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to sort of expand on that for just a second. Mm-hmm. Last week, I published an op-ed in The Atlantic online. You can all find it, called The Most Unhappy of Pleasures.
Yeah.
And basically trying to draw the distinction between pleasure and happiness. They're not the same. In fact, they might actually be opposite. People sort of don't get that. You know, pleasure is fleeting. Happiness is, you know, much more long-lasting. Pleasure is corporal. Happiness is much more spiritual. There are a lot of things that are very different. But most importantly, pleasure is dopamine, as you hear more about today, and happiness is serotonin. It's two different, completely different neurotransmitters, and there is some data that suggests that, in fact, as you downregulate your dopamine receptors, you're also downregulating your serotonin receptors. In other words, the more pleasure you seek, the more unhappy you get. And, in fact, our society has sort of lost the vision, you know. The Bible talks about, you know, happiness. It doesn't talk about pleasure, you know. I mean, remember Sodom and Gomorrah? Not cool. the Declaration of Independence, you know, says we have the inalienable right to, you know, pursuit of happiness. Says nothing about pleasure. The bottom line is because of our current food environment, we can indulge these pleasures, not just like we used to, like once a week, you know, with a nice dessert and enjoy it and, you know, have the ephemeral response to it that was, you know, kind of fun. But in fact, we indulge it once a meal and sometimes more often than that. And as those pleasures get promulgated, the dopamine receptors get downregulated, the serotonin receptors get downregulated, we become more and more unhappy. Therefore, look for more and more pleasure as substitute and ultimately drive ourselves into addiction. So, you know, it's sort of a quasi-societal issue and one that actually transcends this biochemistry, you know, in terms of the philosophy of how our society currently works. Now, I've been attacked by numerous people on the other side saying, you know, you're a Nazi puritanical communist. You know?
No, fascist.
I would venture to say that none of those things are true. I find it really hard to be a Nazi communist. But the fact is, I really do think that happiness is a completely different phenomenon, and we sort of need to wake up to that.
As you put in this article, I have it in front of me, you say delayed gratification is so 20th century. You know, and just a little aside to that, if I may, for you know, I remember as kids, if you had something that you really liked on your plate, you would save it to last. They don't do that anymore. Mm. It's eat that one first, and then you might not eat the rest of it. It's a whole mindset that has shifted that we have to shift.
Right. Right. Life's short. Eat dessert first. I mean, how many pillows have you seen that embroidered on? I mean, I think that's a little bit of a problem, actually.
Yes, it is. All right. Thank you. Dr. Stice, what types of foods or combinations of foods have the highest addiction potential?
It's a very important question, and it's one that we're starting to get our heads around. It seems like fat, sugar and salt are evil, and any combination of those three items are more evil. So it does seem like it's those three variables. And there's, you know, basically what we find when we neuroimage kids that are at risk for future obesity versus not, and then predict future weight gain, the degree to which the oral somatosensory cortex, which is a brain region that basically tells you the fat content of what's in your mouth, and then the primary gustatory cortex, which encodes how sweet the food is in your mouth. Both of those things are hyper-responsive, and having those be hyper-responsive predicts future increases in fat mass. I mean, it's a really strong predictive effect. So the sensory qualities of the food's profoundly important. And there's even some animal research that says if you eat a certain amount of calories from an energy-dense diet. It was actually a study that fed rats the filling of Oreo cookies, which is a perfect combination of fat and sugar, apparently, versus the same number of calories from healthy rat chow. Rat chow is apparently good for you. that you see downregulation in response to it. So it's very specific to the fat content and the sugar content of the food. And we just had a paper come out last week in American Journal of Clinical Nutrition where we found that the degree of activation of your reward circuitry when you get a chocolate milkshake, which you get in our studies, so kids like that, is totally dependent on how frequently you eat ice cream. If you eat ice cream all the time, there's almost no activation of your reward circuitry. But if you never eat ice cream, it's like you've just had an orgasm. It's completely activated. So there is apparently a very high degree of specificity in how frequently you even eat chocolate. Had nothing to do with the activation response to chocolate milkshake, which really suggests to me that it's the fat viscosity that our brain is very good at recognizing, and that's why we overeat those foods.
Can I ask a question about this? Obviously, we're very interested in what in the food is the addictive substance, and you just said fat, sugar, and salt. We deconstructed that in our paper as fast food addictive to look at that, and I certainly want to talk about fat and sugar, but let's deal with salt sort of right now. The data clinically does not support salt per se. We have a lot of patients who have obligate salt loss that I take care of as an endocrinologist, for instance, patients with congenital adrenal hyperplasia, who are on extraordinarily high salt diets, and they crave salt like crazy. But when you treat their mineralocorticoid deficiency appropriately, and when you actually get them to retain salt, their salt craving goes way down, and they won't take nearly as much. So we can modulate that based on appropriate hormonal therapy. And there are other studies that, you know, look at, you know, changes in that reward circuitry with salt, and there do seem to be some animal studies that support this angiotensin II story in animals, but nothing so far that I've seen in humans. What is the data that salt is addictive?
I don't think I said salt was addictive. I think that, you know, if you give kids bowls of fries with or without salt, my guess is they'll eat the salted fries. So it's the combination of foods.
So it's a salience issue.
I think it's a combination of adding salt to fat. It's a savory issue. Okay. It's actually one of the changes that if you go back 20 years ago, there wasn't so much savory.
Well, that's, you know, so the question is it the salt or is it the fat? I liken this to the, you know, issue with tobacco. You add menthol. You know, menthol increases the salience of tobacco, and the fact is that almost all the African Americans consume mentholated cigarettes because that actually works from a salience standpoint for them. It's not the menthol that is addictive, but it makes the tobacco just go down easier, and that may be true for salt as well. But I don't know that salt actually has addictive properties per se. I know that people are very interested in cutting back on salt for all sorts of reasons, but I don't know that salt is an addictive substance on its own.
Okay. Can I just finish the response to my question originally? I didn't get to the there's two other points that I wanted to touch on. One is there's a lot of argument these days that highly processed foods are absorbed more readily and quickly, and that if you look at the addictive potential of drugs and alcohol, the quicker it gets to your brain, the more addictive it is. So the argument is that the highly processed, you know, sugars or fructose, is that has an addictive component that's different than having, like, fruit, which is, you know, fructose. And then the other point was Barbara Rolls has done a beautiful program of research looking at things that cause us to eat more. And one of the things that causes us to eat more is variety. So if you sit down and have a meal with just two things versus four things, you'll almost always eat more if you have four different things that you're eating for a meal. So that's also related to kind of overconsumption. And just want to make sure that the highly processed foods and the you know, eating in a buffet as opposed to preparing one meal at home, it's much easier to overeat at a buffet.
So when you said, so it's not that if you make scrambled eggs and you add, you know, chard and mushrooms and peppers, that's not what you mean. You mean buffet, like lots of choices.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I mean, so if you want to control your, if you want to eat less, eat more boring meals with less variety.
With no salt. Dr. Avina, you had
a comment? I just wanted to chime in on that too, because we've done some of these types of studies both in my lab and in other labs in animal models, and the lab animals are a good way to answer these types of questions, because we can factor out all the other extraneous variables associated with why people like to eat certain types of foods. So we can actually give the rats just one single nutrient to overeat, a palatable nutrient. So we can give animals a high-fat diet that's just high in fat and doesn't contain sugar. It's often difficult to do that with human studies because the foods that people tend to overeat often contains combinations of fats and sugars and even salt. And so what it seems to be, and Dr. Stice has alluded to this, is that it might not necessarily be just the types of nutrients that people overeat, but the combinations in which they're overeating them. We find that the rats are really pretty good at regulating their body weight and caloric intake when you just give them one single palatable food to overeat. When it contains one nutrient, they have good sensing abilities and they can say, okay, let me eat a little bit less of my rat chow. But when you start to add multiple palatable foods and combinations of fats and sugars and salt, that's when it starts to get more difficult for them to be able to regulate their caloric intake, and perhaps that's what might be happening with people. And so while it's important, I think, to understand what specific foods might be addictive, it might not be a simple answer, because the types of foods we eat aren't actually single foods. They're combinations of foods.
Patty, can I say one other
Absolutely.
Thing? There's an awful lot of low-fat foods in the supermarkets, low-energy dense foods. And we did a study. We give people chocolate milkshake in the brain scanner to look at reward sensitivity to see if that predicts risk for obesity. And we did a study where we told them they were going to receive regular high-fat milkshake or low-fat milkshake. And we lied to them. We actually gave them the same milkshake in both conditions. But when the subjects thought they were receiving low-fat milkshake, their reward circuitry was not activated. And there's a lot of evidence that if people eat low-fat foods, they eat a lot more of it than they would the high-fat foods, mm-hmm. oftentimes consuming more calories in the process. But it just struck me that all of our supermarkets that are full of these low-fat food things are totally undermining our ability to fight obesity because people are not finding them as rewarding. They're not getting as much pleasure or satisfaction, even if it's the same food. So that's just an interesting comment.
Just remember, when you take the fat out, the food tastes like cardboard. Mm-hmm. Food industry knows that. They had to do something. So what did they do? Added the sugar. Mm-hmm. Example, snack wells. 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of which were sugar. Mm. So, you know, the caloric content might be the same, but the ultimate macronutrient composition is very different, and how foods get metabolized has a lot to do with what happens in the brain.
We'll touch in, when we talk, the last part of the talk, we talk about solutions and what we can take home to help. We'll go in a little bit more depth with regards to some of these last points. Mr. Prager, for you, were there certain trigger foods that started you down this food addiction path?
Well, to talk about what started me down the path is a little bit unclear to me. You know I ended up as a food addict. What I can tell you that my mother complained to my pediatrician that I, at the juncture of the meal where my brother, who's only 2 years older than me, would have stopped, I just wanted to keep going. My pediatrician assured her, don't worry, he'll outgrow it. And Dr. Joe was just a great guy, but he was just wrong about that. I did not outgrow it. I still have boundaries around what I eat today in terms of how often I eat, the proportions that I eat. I prefer to weigh and measure my food. I want to make clear, the things that I do for me, I do for me because I've been advised that they might work for me. I tried them and they work for me, but they're not the same as saying you should do this. I don't have an opinion about what's right for you or your loved one who's concerned about this. Often I just try to share what my experience is and see if any of it is valuable to others. I do believe that I had a predisposition to wanting to eat. I stole from my mother, and later I had a job at a 7-Eleven type store, and I stole from them, both from the register and from the shelves, so that I could get the amount of food that I wanted to have. I want to make clear I've made amends for both of those. You know, but that's what I did. What I can say as far as trigger foods go, it's my experience and my observation from being around a lot of people who have an experience similar to mine, that flour, which is refined grain, and refined sugar, which is not the same thing as sugar. You know, I can have fruit and vegetables that contain sugar. I eat yogurt that has lactose in it. But that when they're refined, I tend not to be able to find enough on the shelves. I think this is pretty, I don't want to say universal, but it's pretty widespread among others that I know. And I think that in general, refined foods are more, I think it was Dr. Stice, I'm not sure, was talking about the more refined it is, the quicker it gets to the brain. And that's, cocaine is a refinement of a plant, coca leaves, just like table sugar is a refinement of sugar beets or sugar cane. It's the same idea. But I have a number of other things. I also have a problem with volume. I don't oppose fine cuisine. I like food that tastes good. But if I were forced to choose between dainty portions of the finest cuisine in town or piles of whatever I can get at a 7-Eleven, never mind at a restaurant, I'll take the volume. So that's part of what it is for me. It's not only the substance, but it's behavior, and it's the feeling I get when I am over full, you know, when I am unwilling to stop way past the point when other people would have stopped. It's not like I can't say I don't have an off switch, because even when I know I should be pushing it, when I'm active in my addiction, I won't push it even if I know I should be doing so. There are other substances that, for me, don't work. And I include on that list peanuts, which is roasted fat, basically. I shouldn't say that. There's popcorn, which is a butter delivery system. Butter and salt delivery system. I also have trouble with dried fruit, which is an intensification of a natural substance. Take out some of the moisture. The sugars are more intense. And even sugarless gum. I went from someone who was who decided one day to pick up a pack at the convenience store to someone who's spending $12 to $15 a week getting the 8-packs at the grocery store. And not only that, this is I think it's kind of funny. I became the equivalent of a wine snob. You know, I would talk about, well, you know, if you take a stick and a half of the Carefree Gold and you put it with some Bubble Yum watermelon, you get that really good elasticity, but the tartness lasts a long time. And I was going from, I'd lay it on the nightstand at night, and as soon as I woke up in the morning, I'd put it back in my mouth. And I sometimes it would, 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'd take some out because I didn't want a wad the size of Cleveland in my mouth, so I could put some more in and get more flavor. This is insanity, is it not? So I just decided that I should not have any, and I'm much better off when I don't start down those roads. I'd like to tell one more story.
Okay.
When I was I had this real affinity for popcorn, and I was eating the microwave bags at home, and then I was starting to think about it. Somebody was talking about craving. Well, I was starting to think about, when could I have my next one, and when I got home, and do I have enough, and should I make sure I stop and get some? And I finally identified that as a problem, and I wanted to stop. So I made a rule. I made a rule that I would only eat popcorn when I go to the movies, because, that's natural. Everybody does that. But I actually reached the day, I swear this is true, where I didn't look at the listings for the movies. I just went to the theater. Not because it was a movie I wanted to see, but because I was entitled, when I was at the theater, to have popcorn. And first, I chose the theater based on the fact that they served real butter, not the fake stuff. And then, much to my disappointment, when I got there, there was not a movie on the marquee that I wanted to see. There was only one movie that I was willing to see. I had already seen it. I didn't want to see it again, but I did. Because that gave me permission to eat the popcorn. It's insane behavior. And soon after that, I just decided I'm better off if I don't start with that substance. And many people have different trigger foods. I have a friend who has identified 72 of them. And it's just, I'm better off when I don't take these substances in.
Thank you. Dr. Lustig, is there a connection between high fructose and you say fructose? Which one should I say?
It's both.
Okay,
both.
I'm going to go with.
If you go
fructose,
to the dictionary, bloggers like to be nasty about this. They say if you go to the dictionary, both fructose and fructose are both correct, and fructose is first.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
I want to make that
very
clear.
I'll try.
Okay.
Hi.
All right.
So
I learned it way back when in college as fructose. I'm a creature of habit, and that's just life, and that's, you're just going to have to deal, okay?
Well, I can deal, out of respect for you. Is there a connection between high fructose, corn syrup, and food addiction? And, I'm sure you'll be speaking about our livers a little bit in here, and then if it's appropriate in your answer to this question, I would like a little bit of explanation about sugar alcohols as well, since we're talking sugar.
Okay. Well, all right. There's no question that there is a relation between sugar and addiction. That's very clear. Through what mechanism, we're still working on that. That's not entirely clear yet. Whether high fructose corn syrup is worse than sucrose in terms of this particular phenomenon, I don't think anybody knows that at this point. Certainly, this question that Dr. Steis brought up about things getting into your system quicker. The difference between high fructose corn syrup and sucrose, from a caloric standpoint, is non-existent. The question is whether the bond between the glucose and the fructose, which has been broken in high fructose corn syrup, makes a difference is not clear. Richard Johnson's group at Colorado recently published a paper in Metabolism where they took rats, it's again rats, not humans, took rats and they gave them equal amounts of sucrose and high fructose corn syrup, 50-50 high fructose corn syrup, so it wasn't even the 55-45. isocaloric and asked the question, how high did the serum fructose go? And in their study, the serum fructose rose higher when the bond was broken, as opposed to when it was sucrose where the bond was intact. So they would make the case that there is at least some reason to suspect that high fructose corn syrup might be worse. I don't know that. I do know that sugar matters. I do know that sugar matters at many different levels. I know that sugar changes your insulin resistance at the level of the liver. The higher your insulin goes, the less well your brain can see leptin. Leptin is the hormone that your fat cells make that go to your brain that tell you you've had enough, you don't need to eat so much, and that you can burn energy at a normal rate. Work from Ralph DeLeon at Yale animal studies shows that leptin turns off the reward system. So when your brain can see leptin, your reward system works properly and you can stop. Insulin blocks that effect, so when your insulin goes up, your brain basically can't see its leptin, and therefore you continue to consume. That part we know. Whether or not high fructose corn syrup, because of this effect in the liver, you know, because of this effect of the double bond, of the bond being broken, might make it worse, that's not yet clear. So I don't know the answer yet.
Dr. Avina, does the American Medical Association or the American Psychiatric Association recognize food addiction as a disease or a psychiatric disorder? Which diagnosis would be better, treatment-wise, for food addicts?
Well, the short answer to this is no. That as of right now, there is no medical classification for food addiction. It's not something that if you go to the doctor, you could be diagnosed with having food addiction. There are no medical criteria or psychiatric criteria that are specific for food addiction. What researchers have done, what I believe, and some of the medical doctors can attest to this if it's being done off-label, is to basically take the characteristics that have been described in the DSM-4, which is the diagnostic manual that psychiatrists use to diagnose substance dependence, but apply them toward food. And so animal studies and studies that have been done in humans have really used those addiction criteria that are meant for drug addiction but applied them to the study of food addiction. And in many cases, that can be done with patients in terms of treatment. But as of right now, the AMA and the APA do not have food addiction listed as a criteria, or food addiction listed as a classification. And it's important because this is one of the barriers that we're facing now. And I think a lot of it has to do with really just sort of the timing of how sort of the timeline of the study of food addiction has come to be. Again, I think this is a relatively young field in the sense that it's really only recently that we've been able to accrue a lot of empirical data that supports the idea that this is a real phenomenon, that food addiction does exist for some people, and that it is something that we do need to address in a treatment-wise fashion. So I'm hoping that with time, as more and more data accrue, that this will be something that we will be able to see a diagnostic criteria for. And it is important in terms of, you know, care, because if there's no insurance codes associated with a disorder, then, you know, how can we treat patients? It also is important in terms of the standard of care. If we don't have a standard of care in place for how a medical doctor should be treating someone who has a food addiction, then we're not having uniformity across the board. So again, I think, you know, the answer right now is no, there are no criteria in place, but perhaps with time that will change as these things do change.
Okay. Dr. Appel? Tell us about the role of opioids, stress, and food addiction.
That's a triple-layered question.
Sorry.
Well, I want to point out as a bridge from what we've been talking about that it's helpful to think of what kind of eating you're doing at any moment. So eating is not just eating. There's homeostatic eating when you eat because you haven't eaten for a while and you have caloric need, and so there's a hunger signal. And we don't pay much attention to that, but part of what we do in our treatments, our mindful treatments for healthy eating, is have people pay attention to their own natural weak hunger signal. Sorry, not weak. The satiety signal is what's weak. So that's what we call homeostatic eating. And then there's also reward-based eating. And this is eating not for caloric need. We may be satiated and full, but when you see that chocolate mousse, all of a sudden you have another whole flood of hunger, which is reward-based. So, and the two are mixed, of course, because when we haven't eaten for a while, food tastes better and we have a stronger drive for it. But if we think about this eating for calories versus eating for reward, what is that that brain system about reward? One of the chemicals you asked about was opioids. So clearly opioids, this pleasurable chemical, is released when we eat, and so it's rewarding. And also, if you apply opioids into certain parts of the brain, the reward area, that stimulates eating. So there is, I would say, a bidirectional relationship that we need to think about when we think about why is someone overeating. So it could be mere exposure to highly palatable food is shaping the reward system to have it's, you know, it's changing the brain, as we know from some of the very elegant animal studies like Nicole's been doing. We can cause a food addiction by exposure to highly palatable food, particularly if the animal gets the withdrawal, so they're withdrawal from the food, so that it's intermittent exposure. So the exposure route causes the drive, but there's also, you can just start with feeling bad. So feeling bad can be confused with hunger and can cause eating. And there's also feeling bad because not because of emotions, but because of what we call hedonic withdrawal from not eating. So when the brain feels like it's being starved, like when you're on a diet, that feels really bad. And that is a state of hedonic withdrawal and causes a strong drive to eat again. So it goes both ways. You can start with feeling bad, that drives the food, or you can be exposed to food and then go through hedonic withdrawal from not having the food afterward. So there's this very tight kind of bidirectional relationship between how we feel and eating and palatable food. I do want to point out that dieting feels bad. When people usually are, their brain thinks they're starving, that feels really bad. But there is one group that I know of that actually feels really good when they feel that hunger signal. And that is, we've been studying a group of chronic caloric restrictors. And they, through cognitive mechanisms, when they feel hungry, they reappraise it. They're thinking of it differently. Even though their body might be sending danger signals, they reappraise it as, this is the goal, and I am going to live longer. This is a really good feeling. So actually, they're living with those feelings of discomfort and hunger in a very different way than all the rest of us. Only we could bottle up that up, right? So in this, some of the, I'll tell you about study demonstrating the role of opioids that I think is very enlightening. So in certain rat studies by Mary Boggiano, what she has done is cause rats to be exposed to a junk food diet, including Oreos, and then she withdraws the food. So the rats' brains have changed, and now they have strong drive. But they actually don't binge much when she gives them the junk food again. But then if she adds stress to the mix, that sensitizes the brain, then they really want the junk food, and they have a huge binge. So it's actually the combination of both the intermittent access to junk food and the stress, and they work in combination. The stress alone doesn't do much. The Oreos alone don't do much. And then she's done subsequent studies where she blocks the opioids in the brain with naloxone, and she actually blocks the binge behavior. So we know that the opioids are important and really part of that out-of-control addictive binge. We're doing studies in people where we're trying to, Marin Thompson's leading that up, who's here, we're trying to look at the role of opioids and really kind of an individual difference model, test how sensitive people are to opioids and if that predicts how well they do in weight loss and whether some of our treatments can change their opioid sensitivity. So we know that's one individual factor we're trying to shape and work with to help people have a less of a kind of addictive response to food. And then lastly, I think some of our treatments are really working on trying to shift people from that reward-based eating and that unconscious eating to more of a mindful eating by teaching them attentional skills to pay attention to food. So we do that with Jean Christeller and with colleagues at UCSF and Jennifer Dobinmier, who's here, is leading up some of that.
Thank you. Dr. Tarman, willpower versus biochemistry. How can we help people understand the difference, and why is it important?
Okay, I'd like to, before I attempt that question, just pick up on a couple of threads that were brought up, and one of them is that on-off switch, which it works really well with my population. I mean, if I really wanted to say what's the definition of addiction, it's just so simple to say it's somebody who doesn't have that off switch. But it's not necessarily the off switch of I will choose not to use or not. It's the craving and the obsessional thinking. And, you know, think about, you know, what's a typical off switch? When I'm really thirsty, like I happen to be right now, a glass of water tastes delicious, and I'll love that glass of water, and I might even have a second and enjoy that. But a third one, it's not so enjoyable, and by the fourth one, I'm getting irritated because the person's saying, you liked it, have another one. No, it actually, the off switch is there, I don't want any more, thank you. But if it's a beer or if it's a milkshake, if it's popcorn, I might just be able to fit more in because there's a disorder with that off switch, it's not there anymore. That where that on-off switch is, I think that that's where the neurochemistry is. I mean, we have scientists here who are elucidating what that actually is. And on a clinical level, I like to say it as this is that part of us that is not, it's the unconscious part of us. It's the part of us that we can't control. It's the part of us that if I have to go, pardon me to use this example, if I have to go to the bathroom and I'm stressed out, at some point I will not be able to control my bladder if I am that stressed. I mean, the level of addiction is on that level. And willpower, I like to say it's got a short half-life. It works, but it's got a short half-life or a short shelf life. And sure, I can say no, but if the impulse is there and the craving and the obsession is there on a continual basis, I am really asking myself, putting myself at risk, or my patient is putting themselves at risk. When a person comes into our recovery program and they look at the type of treatment that we suggest, usually they'll say, you know what, this is all very nice, but it's not for me. And I know that they're essentially, we use the term, you're too smart for your own recovery. They're expecting to use their intellect and their willpower to get themselves out of addiction, which is not the way to go. It has to be at that subconscious sort of animal part of us, which is very offensive to our intellect, unfortunately. I guess that's the answer to the question is willpower is nice, it's helpful, but it is not the answer. And a person who stays with that we call that a dry drunk, they're just hanging on until, you know, if they haven't focused on the other aspect, then they're in trouble. Can I take another minute?
Sure.
Yeah. Another acronym that we use is in addiction is hungry, angry, lonely, tired. If you want to have success in recovery, don't focus on willpower. Yes, you want to use it, learn how to use it as much as you can, and I'll throw into that mindfulness as well. I think that those things are really essential, but you have to find a way to deal with that unconscious part of us, and the hungry, angry, lonely, tired part is great. Don't put yourself into a place where you're going to need that willpower. So don't be hungry. So the person who's on a diet is on a food plan should not let themselves get hungry. Don't put yourself in a position where you're going to be angry or lonely or tired. That gives the stresses which will then provoke you to having those obsessional thoughts to then rely on willpower, which is so weak. So you have to deal with both angles. On that all
thank you. Dr. Lustig has
a comment. I want to elaborate on what Dr. Tarman said. When we talk about willpower, we're talking about basically behavior, right? So what's the definition of behavior? Anybody want to come up with a definition of that word? There is a real honest-to-goodness definition. Go to the dictionary, and there's a real honest-to-goodness definition. Anybody want to venture a guess as to what the real definition of behavior is?
How I act?
Nope.
Something you do over and over again?
No, get close. That's part of it. Okay, here it is. A stereotyped motor response to a physiological stimulus. That is the definition of behavior. Okay, and that's not open for discussion. You can take that up with Noah Webster if you want.
Period.
Okay. Stereotype, same every time. So, yes, eating is a behavior because it looks the same every time you do it. Motor, muscles have to move. A thought is not a behavior. And finally, physiological. Physiological, that's the important one. Because what it says is that every behavior is really a physiological process that drove that. When you think about it, and we are all neuroscientists sitting up here, that is exactly what we're dealing with. We are basically looking at the output of a physiological biochemical process. I take care of children with endocrine disorders. Okay? Kid walks in, 4 years old, is drinking 10 gallons of water a day, urinating 10 gallons of water a day. Kid's got diabetes insipidus. Now, could the kid be a psychogenic water drinker? You know, one out of 200, yeah, but 199 out of 200, no. It's a biochemical process. You see the behavior, immediately you infer the biochemistry. You see a 25-year-old who falls asleep in his soup. You know, what's he got? He's got narcolepsy. It's a defect in orexins in the midbrain. Schizophrenia for 100 years was a behavioral disorder. We now know it's a defect in dopamine neurotransmission, a different part of the brain. Bottom line. Behavior is not behavior. Behavior is the output of these biochemical processes. What we call behavior, colloquially, is actually the cognitive supertentorial inhibition on a biochemical process, which is going on 24/7, 365. How long do you think you can deal with that? How long do you think you can put up with that? How long do you think you can control that? Forget it. That's the recidivism of pretty much all behaviors, is because no one has that level of willpower, because you're fighting a biochemical process that's continuing to go on all the time. Ultimately, the only way to control those is to control the environment. And that's ultimately what, you know, is the big bugaboo in terms of understanding addiction research, is controlling the environment, controlling the availability of the substance that caused the problem in the first place. Then we get into other issues, the societal interventions, public health interventions, why all addictions have laws that deal with them other than food addiction. So that's that takes us to a new level we'll talk about in terms of treatment.
Thank you. Dr. Stice?
I wanted to follow up on the biochemistry aspect because I think it's a very it's a fundamental question. And what it turns out is the biochemistry that gets you walking down a path of overeating is completely different from the biochemistry that keeps you stuck in a pattern of overeating. So initially it appears that people who are vulnerable to later become obese show greater responsivity of your reward circuitry to when you get money, when you get food. Basically, reward is more powerful for you. And the inhibitory parts of your brains, that's the prefrontal regions, is deactivated. It doesn't, you know, if you're sitting there watching a television commercial for an unhealthy food, the reward circuitry fires up and the inhibitory circuitry sort of turns off. But a lot of that is a byproduct of overeating repeatedly. So the more you do something, the more you do crack cocaine, the more you eat a really high energy dense food like ice cream or something like that, the more you're changing your brain in the following ways: that you pay a lot more attention to food cues, so you'll notice that McDonald's sign as you're driving down the freeway when you wouldn't have before, that you relax your inhibitory control regions, and you show a hypervigilance of kind of the reward valuation regions of your brain. It's like the orbital frontal cortex, your caudate. This is when you're looking at a menu and deciding what to order for dinner, those are the reward valuations regions of your brain that is firing up and saying, yeah, I'm going to go with this because that was what I got most excited about. Those are all an effect of habitual overeating. If you never do that, if you're a parent and you have kids and you can help them not get exposed to really energy-dense foods on a regular basis, you can prevent those processes from occurring. But those are the processes that keep you stuck in a pattern of overeating. So it's more like walking a mile in the shoes of overeating or doing cocaine or whatever it is, that you change your neurochemistry so that you're hypervigilant for more of that, and you get stuck in this sort of never-ending cycle.
Fascinating. The remainder of our talk, we're going to talk about solutions, prevention, thoughts, and that's going to be fascinating. And then we're also going to take plenty of time for your questions and answers. We've saved a lot of time today for that. So before we begin on those two points, the rest of the talk, I think we'll take a break right now, and it'll be the last break until 3. And then and I think we'll, before you have to leave, Dr. Lustig, I think we'll have enough time for some Q&As for you. So let's take a 10-minute break. We'll come back at 20 till 2 and finish. Thank you. I read something you know, next we're talking about solutions, and that's very much in quotes, and you'll know why as they continue to speak on treatments and solutions to this. But I read something the other day on several different websites, actually, and I find it an interesting comment. Alcoholics will say that they've put the tiger in the cage with the alcohol. But in Overeaters Anonymous, they say they have to take the tiger out of the cage 3 times a day and take it for a walk. Whoa. It's a powerful visual for you, isn't it? And it gives you a little bit of an idea of how tough this is. So that's, I thought, a pretty good lead-in as to the next part of our talk, and that is solutions and leaving plenty of time. Some of you have handed me your cards because you'd rather I ask the questions. That's fine. Or after we're done this next section, feel free to ask your own questions. I do ask that it's one question at a time, and then if you have a second question, just get in the line again, and I'll let you know when the time is as to get in line to ask your questions. So, Dr. Tarman. Is it difficult treating food addicts when they aren't recognized as such?
Oh, thank you. That's such a good question for me because that really is at the heart of my passion for wanting to speak on this subject. As I say, I've been working in the field of addiction for long enough that I get really frustrated when I see this substitution phenomenon occurring from alcohol to cocaine to food. I see that it's always the missing piece of the puzzle. There's all sorts of great treatments that we offer, but we're not looking at the food addiction piece. And I think it's often the missing piece of the puzzle for why the relapse will occur. So, you know, the treatment paradigm that I'm working under is one that doesn't include food addiction. We've acknowledged that. There's no food addiction diagnosis. And when we're talking from a clinician's point of view, that's really crucial because diagnosis determines treatment. So the diagnosis today is you have an eating disorder or you're a compulsive overeater. You're not a food addict, but you're anything above. And the types of treatment based on that diagnosis are sort of in three realms. It's almost like a pyramid. There's the top of the pyramid, which is surgical. So we have somebody who's obese. What do we offer? We offer bariatric surgery. And that's, by the way, where a lot of the attention is, and the whole obesity area is focusing. Who is it that's funding the, I don't know if that's funding the research, but funding the advertisements about obesity? It's the the bariatric clinics. But how helpful is that? Well, I'm going to reserve judgment at the moment. Then the next level of the pyramid is the medications. And the medications that I can use to treat for obesity or addiction are things like antidepressants, the idea being that if you're not so depressed, you won't reach your food, if you're not so stressed, you won't reach for your food. There are amphetamines, get your weight down, or don't want to eat because you're taking so much amphetamine, whether it's dexedrine or if it's cocaine or crack. Anyway, it will curb your appetite. Or mood moderators, I know that they're looking at some kind of hormonal medication as well. But those medications, if you're looking at a food addict, they actually, some of them create food cravings, sugar cravings. I see people on antidepressants, they gain weight. And I say, why are you gaining weight? And not just antidepressants, but antipsychotics. You probably have different names than we have up in Canada. But they create sugar cravings, create weight gain. They're actually counterproductive to a food addict. And then finally, the bottom level of treatment that I'm working the paradigm under is behavior modification, in other words, diet. I like to think about it. What does diet stand for? If you take the T off of diet, what does it stand for? D-I-E, die. The kind of diet that I'm allowed to propose is basically what we call moderation. You get to, in my treatment program, you get to learn how to eat just one dessert, a meal or a day or maybe once a week or something like that, but you're going to still be able to eat your dessert. And if I want to use the addiction paradigm, which I want to use, and say, no, in fact, you may have designated that your trigger food is popcorn or it's peanut butter or something like that, you may never, ever be able to eat that again. In the same way that an alcoholic, you're not going to learn how to just have one drink, not if you're following an abstinence model. You're just not going to ever have popcorn again. That's just the way it is. No more trigger foods. If I propose that in this current day, that's going to be considered a pathological approach. I'm teaching the person to be an anorexic. I'm teaching them a far too rigid Nazi, I don't know what the words are, but I'm certainly not applauded by that approach. And the standard of practice in a medical or psychiatric care in food is to propose moderation. And that, if we were to shift that over to the addiction paradigm, that would be like using a harm reduction approach in addiction. It's like, yeah, you're going to still use your drug, but it won't be as bad as it used to be. But harm reduction approach is a really great approach when you're looking at a societal larger picture. But when you're looking at the individual suffering, I can tell you that I see a lot more serene food addicts who have put down their substance rather than the ones that are still struggling with, I just want to do one whenever. I mean, that battle, you're continually in that decisive mode. It's not a serene place to be. So where the treatment is today, it's a sorry place, and I would really like to see that treatment be at least that we offer, to have on the table of options, because not everybody's a food addict, not every bulimic or binge eating disorder person with those disorders is a food addict, but of those who are, that there at least be an acceptable solution of abstinence from trigger foods or even trigger behaviors, at least that it be an option on the table that is not considered pathological.
Thank you. Dr. Avina, from a psychological standpoint, how can we treat food addiction? 12-step program the best option? Individual or group therapy? What treatment options do you see as the most effective?
Well, before I can answer that, I think it's important to take a step back and think about, when we talk about the term food addiction, what exactly do we mean? And so we've been talking about that, you know, for the better part of the day here, and I don't know if we've actually quite defined what a food addiction is. And so I think that's something that the science is still trying to uncover. We're really working hard to, you know, refine the terms and the language to make this something that we can, you know, apply a diagnosis toward. I think that we're all primed to be addicted to food. If you think about it, we need food to live. We have a desire to want to eat. We need to eat and we need to mate. We need to do some other behaviors in order to make sure that we survive as a species. So there's an evolutionary advantage to being addicted to food. And that makes sense, but the problem is that the types of foods that people tend to overeat are not necessarily the types of foods that our brains were primed to make us want to overeat. And so if we think about sort of our primitive brains that, you know, hunters and gatherers had to forage for food and we had to identify food when we found it and make sure we eat a lot of it because we didn't know when we were going to get our next meal. And so we're now in a social situation in which food is, for most of us, ubiquitous, and we can pretty much go anywhere and find access to highly caloric foods. And so we might still have these primitive urges to overeat when food is there, but we don't necessarily need to act on them. And so when we talk about food addiction, I think it's important to refine the term a bit and not necessarily talk about food, but talk about palatable food or highly palatable foods that we don't need to eat. We don't necessarily need to eat these highly palatable, highly caloric foods in order to survive as a species. Of course, we need to eat food, but there might be a line that we need to draw at some point. I don't know where it will be drawn, but to dissociate the foods that are potentially addictive versus the foods that are healthy and the things that we should eat a lot of. And so I think that's something that we're grappling with both, you know, on the scientific level and on the treatment level in terms of how we can go forward and talk about treating food addiction before we define it. But in terms of what I think might work in terms of treatments, there's a couple of levels, and I think prevention is certainly a part of this, and I won't say too much about that because I know Patty has planned at the end for us to talk a little bit about prevention, but certainly preventing palatable food addiction or excessive overeating from happening in the first place is clearly key. But in terms of the other levels, there are multiple things. If we take a page from the drug abuse world, and I think that that's the direction in which we'll probably be going with the treatment of food addiction, the treatments and the things that have worked in treating drug abuse are the things that I think we should be looking at in terms of treating food abuse or excessive overeating. And again, you know, it's unfortunately limited because there aren't all that many very successful treatments for drug addiction. And so in terms of the psychological aspects of this, the 12-step programs that certainly have been useful in treating drug addiction, and we see that this is happening with, you know, programs like Overeaters Anonymous, for instance, that are adopting a similar type of style of treating patients with group therapy. There's also, you know, the idea that the treatment is important. I think the underlying sort of importance in the type of psychological treatment that we're thinking of in terms of a therapy is that recognizing that there is a maladaptive attachment to certain types of food. And I think perhaps even Michael might be able to speak a little bit about this as well. I think that is key because a lot of the treatment programs that are put forward, if it's not recognizing that the person is acknowledging that they have a maladaptive attachment towards food, admitting that and recognizing that as one of the symptoms I think is critical in terms of moving forward with a treatment plan. And then finally, there's also the pharmacological interventions, which, again, we can take a page from the drug abuse world and look at the drugs that have worked and, you know, have been useful in curtailing drug use. And those might be some of the ones that we would look at in terms of how to curtail excessive overeating. And I think the science is gaining ground, and there's studies that are going on right now that are looking at the overlaps between, you know, using treatments for drug abuse and how they might apply to food abuse as well.
Thank you. Dr. Lustig, is there a way to reverse the reward circuitry in our brain? And please delve into any medications specifically that might be helpful.
You know, Patty told me she was going to ask me that, and I said, why are you going to ask me that? First of all, I would assume that if you can rewire your brain to be an addict, you can probably rewire it not to be. The question is, what does it take? How long does it take? What's necessary? And I'm going to tell you right now, I have no blessed clue. But let me give you a paradigm to think about. Who here saw Super Size Me? Okay, good. So go re-rent it. Okay, this is your homework assignment. Okay. And, you know, buzz through it with your, you know, fast forward and get to day 18 of Morgan Spurlock's ordeal. And he's sitting on his girlfriend's bed talking to the camera. And she's making her vegan whatever in her kitchen behind him. And he's talking to the camera and he says the following, you know, I was feeling really awful. I was feeling like, you can bleep that out. I was feeling sick and tired and unhappy. Started eating. Now I feel great. I feel so great it's crazy. Ain't that right, babe? And she yells back, yeah, you're crazy, all right. Okay. This is day 18. And what he had just described is withdrawal. He hadn't eaten in 4 hours, and now he needed his hit. Okay. So here's a guy who was a vegan, presumably, because his girlfriend was. You know, tipping the scales at 160 pounds, and within 18 days, he is describing withdrawal. And I believe that that indeed is the case. I think that anyone can slip into this at one point or another. There are probably certain genetic influences that Dr. Stice mentioned, for instance, this TAC1 allele of the dopamine D2 receptor. So if you have fewer of those, that means you need more dopamine to be able to get the same effect through the law of mass action. So I think there are probably ways and people who are going to be more susceptible than others. But ultimately, I think anybody can have this happen to them if the food's there and the situation's right. I also think that there are things that increase the salience of food. And I think the biggest one that really has not been mentioned today is caffeine. Caffeine's a disaster. Hey, now, look. If you take my caffeine away from me, I will kill you. Okay? And all of my fellows know, you know, that, you know, Rob's going to come to conference every morning, you know, loaded with his 2 cups of coffee because, you know, that's the thing that gets me out of bed in the morning. Bottom line is we need our addiction system. Our addiction system is how we have made it these millions of years. And we actually know what happens when we turn off the addiction system because about 5 years ago there was this drug called Rimonabant, which was an endocannabinoid antagonist. Basically, it shut down the reward system. Was, you know, used as an obesity drug, and it worked great. It worked terrific, except for one little problem. 20% of the people who got it became severely clinically depressed, and a bunch of them went and committed suicide, and the FDA never approved it for just that reason. So we need our addictions because that's pleasure. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning. So the concept that we can totally reverse it or turn it off is, and especially when it comes to food, where we need it for caloric balance, we need it for energy, we need it for, you know, the amino acids and the fatty acids that are necessary to actually maintain health, you know, is basically, I mean, you know, we can't turn it off. We can't just turn it off. It's not possible. So how do we ultimately peacefully coexist with it? That's really what we want to know. And I don't know. I know that putting caffeine in it ain't a good idea. I know that. And so that's why soft drinks are such a problem. And I take care of obese kids. And I will tell you right now, it is very hard to take care of obese kids because the parents are obese. Not because just that the kids are addicted, they are, but that the parents are addicted. So I really have two patients. And if you think that I can get a kid to lose weight when the mother keeps bringing that, you know, problematic food or the soda into the house for her own addiction or his own addiction, you know, it's just not possible. Ultimately, the parent's job is to make the home safe for the child. Okay, everyone agrees with that. That is the parent's job. And ultimately, the home is not safe for the child. Point is, how do you fix the, you know, food addict parent when we can't even fix the drug addict parent? So, you know, these are sort of the things that are weighing over us as we talk about this. All right, so what do we have? There's a drug out there. It's actually a combination drug called Contrave. It's made by Orexigen Pharmaceuticals, and it's bupropion and naltrexone. So the bupropion is an antidepressant designed to increase happiness. The naltrexone is an opiate antagonist designed to decrease reward. And the FDA has not approved it for various reasons known only to them. The bottom line is the FDA hasn't approved very many drugs. They've taken a whole bunch away. You know, having said that, they just approved Qnexa, which is interesting, which is phentermine, which is adrenergic, and topiramate, which is a drug that basically puts your brain to sleep. You know, it's got zombie-like effects, the patients who take it say. But the bottom line is, you know, these are the way pharmaceutical companies are approaching the issue, as, you know, that there is a food addiction and that we can potentially alter these pathways through these drugs. Now, taking a piece from the drug addiction playbook, I mean, what's the best treatment for heroin addiction? Methadone, right? Well, so is methadone an opiate antagonist? No. Methadone's an opiate agonist. Okay, it is heroin. It's just long-acting heroin, so you don't get the peaks and the valleys. So you take your pill every day. It's also well-absorbed orally. So should we basically, you know, chalk it up to, you know, okay, look, this person's a food addict. Let's go ahead and keep his reward system stimulated with a medicine that keeps reward up so that they don't need the peaks and the valleys that would come from consuming food. You know, people are looking at that as a possible answer. Bottom line is, I think that ultimately there'll be as many drugs for this as there are people who have this problem, because everybody's got a little different, and different, as Dr. Stice mentioned, different foods probably serve as different triggers for different people, and so I don't know how we're going to deal with this from a drug standpoint yet. Ultimately, I think we have to deal with the environment. That's the best way to deal with it.
Thank you. Mr. Prager, from everything you know, could you name something, whether an aha moment or a treatment regimen, that helped you overcome your addiction?
Yes, I can. I'll talk about the aha moment first. And to that I can say no. Anything that I have since had an aha moment about came only in retrospect. I'll tell you that when people suggested, you know, not just people on the street, but people who had, I had reason to believe they might know what they're talking about, and so I should take them seriously. When they suggested that I might be an addict, I was not pleased. I did not think, yippee, I'm an addict, now I'm going to get better. But I was just open-minded enough to try one thing, maybe, or two things. And when I saw that I felt differently as a result of these actions that I took, I was willing to take more actions, despite the fact that my intellect was telling me that's not going to work. You know, I think someone may have been Dr. Terman had mentioned that addicts are often victimized by their intellect, and that was certainly true in my case. You know, I would have done much better if I was just a little more stupid. Now, as far as a treatment regimen, what I can say happened for me is that people at work, when I lived in Hartford, Connecticut, working at a newspaper there, they knew that if they came to me and said, we think you're unhappy, you should get some help, that I would have been angry and that I would not have listened to them. So they went to my boss, and they had him call me in. Not that I was in trouble, but I've done therapy, and it worked for me. I think you should do it. So I started down that road, and I eventually got hooked up with a therapist who believed in addiction, and he started suggesting I start sampling support groups, and then he suggested that I go to this rehab facility with South Oaks Hospital in Amityville, New York. They had an eating disorders unit then. They do not any longer in general. Eating disorder treatment is far less available today than it was then. I could tell some stories around why that is, but you probably want to go home at some time today. Have continued. I have gone back to some quasi treatment settings because I got in trouble again. But it was less intense, and it was also less involved because whereas my treatment in 1991 cost my insurance company in the neighborhood of $54,000, the treatment that was available to me by 1999, the other time that I went away, that was 9 weeks. This was 5 days, and it was in a rented chalet. And so the institution no longer had an institution. It was just the practitioners. There was no medical component. And it was what I call itinerant rehab, you know, where they were still trying to make some of the same, accomplish some of the same goals, but with a lot less infrastructure to do it. It was by surrendering to the idea that I didn't have all the answers and that maybe other people did, that I started to get better. It's interesting, right at the beginning of this process, it was suggested to me that I not have any refined sugar or any flour. And to the first part, I said, okay, that wasn't an issue for me because I'm a volume eater as much as any substance, as I said earlier. So what it meant for me is that I could no longer stop for a dozen donuts at night, but I could still get a dozen bagels and put cream cheese on it, and I was still getting a refined substance and a fat to put on it. But that when I heard about the flour, I said, similar to what somebody else said in a different setting just a minute ago, you can have the pasta. You can pry the pasta fork from my cold, dead hand. You know, there's nothing wrong with flour. You can't make me give it up. It's not a problem for me. And why the strong reaction? I had an aha moment about that only in retrospect. If they had been talking about Brussels sprouts, I would have said, okay. The fact that I was so adamant about it should have told me that I had a connection to this substance that was not healthy. And it was only when I was still binging, not nearly as often. What I'll tell you is that after my recovery, after going to rehab, never did I gain so much weight back that I still wasn't a 100-pound loser. So my life was still a lot better, and things were going a lot better, and I was still a 100-pound loser. But still, the difference between 100 and 160 is still pretty broad, and my weight was going up and down. And somebody said during one of these times, is it possible that when you do binge, and you, what I was doing was pounding flour products, mostly with fat combined. Is it possible that this behavior makes your binges more intense and more long-lasting? And I was at just the right point of pain where I said, okay, maybe it's possible. And so I gave it up finally after 7 years after I got the suggestion. And I haven't gone back to it, not because I'm virtuous, but because I finally got to experience what life was like without this substance, and I was happier. I was happier. I was embarrassed, ashamed that it took me 7 years to find this out, when if I had just figured it out, I always could have added it back if it wasn't a problem for me. But it turned out that it was a problem for me, and I'm happy not to eat that. So part of it, what I do is I abstain from sugar and flour and these other substances that I mentioned earlier. I do believe in abstinence. When you talk about the suggestion that alcoholics and drug addicts get is not moderation, is not just have a little bit of what you're going to have. We don't suggest that they take the tiger out of the cage 3 times a day. And I do believe that there are some substances that I have a biochemical sensitivity to, and I'm better off when I don't start. That's my behavior. And even if I'm wrong about it, I still get the benefit of not starting. I noticed also Dr. Lustig said, I'll kill you if you take away my caffeine. Well, I often say in my writing, I write a blog about these topics, and I often say that my opinion is that people gave up sugar and flour to the extent that I have, which is not the same as just not putting sugar in your coffee anymore, because there's sugar in everything. You know, there's salad dressing and on meats and all sorts of things, where you wouldn't think it would be. But if you really gave it up for 30 days, I believe quite a few people would decide not to go back, just like I decided not to go back. And I don't feel deprived by that at all. I feel grateful that I finally found out that this stuff isn't good for me, and that if I don't put it in my body, I'll be happier. But I'm also very confident when I make this suggestion that I'm never going to be proved wrong. Because when I make the suggestion, someone is sure to say, "What? Give up sugar? I'd rather die." Well, that's, to me, the same kind of reaction that I had with the flour. If it wasn't such a big deal, and you weren't, and it was easy to just check it out, then there might be something to be learned for each person's personal experience. I think I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Stice, what are the policy implications of the evidence from brain imaging studies on vulnerability factors for obesity?
Well, I think there's a few, and I think one of it is, you know, once, again, the initial vulnerability factors that get you started in a period of overeating are different than those that maintain overeating. And actually, I think one of the biggest implications for me is I've been very humbled by how many really brilliant people have tried to treat obesity and have failed. That virtually all obesity treatments, I mean, certainly the word on the street today is that bariatric surgery is the only treatment that produces long-term weight loss. That's the only thing that works. And all the other things we've done, behavioral interventions, cognitive interventions, ultimately fail. Everybody basically regains all the lost weight. So to me, I think the biggest implication of that is that we ought to be doing prevention. We should sort of say treatment is really, really hard. We're not succeeding there. We've tried for decades and decades. So let's put our money into helping somebody not get to this situation rather than trying to get them out of it. So I think that's probably one of the biggest policy implications. And we, you know, if you think about it, there's, you know, if you develop a new treatment for obesity or some other medical condition, there's an army of people who treat these conditions, and you just have to teach them to do it instead of what they were doing before to treat these conditions. There's not an army of prevention people out there. They don't exist. You know, we've developed a lot of prevention programs, some of which work very well for certain conditions, but we have to go out and recruit people from high schools and colleges and train them to deliver these interventions and try to support them continuing to deliver these interventions, and it's really stinking hard. Like, we don't have an infrastructure for prevention yet. So I think that would be one of the biggest implications, is that we need to create a prevention sort of network that will work in our schools earlier on. One of the other things, I think, though, that comes out of the parallels between the drug abuse literature and the obesity literature is one of the, I think, the most consistently observed findings. If you're an addict, so if you're addicted to coffee, and I'm one of those, or if you're addicted to any other drugs, your brain will get super excited when you see any cues that remind you of that thing. So if I walk down the street, when I see that little green thing that looks like a Starbucks sign, I'm like, it's like, oh, is that a Starbucks sign? Mm-hmm. It's that hypervigilance that you get because you've had that reward. The same thing happens to people who are addicted to cocaine. You know, they see a dollar bill or a mirror or a razor blade, a credit card, anything that they might have used in using cocaine, and they crave. They totally want to do the drug because they see those things. The same exact thing happens with food cues. So for obese individuals, when they're watching television and an unhealthy food commercial comes on, the reward circuitry fires up, the inhibitory circuitry turns off. All these things cause craving that leads to food seeking and food intake. If we wanted to really make it easy on people, we would do things to our culture, our environment, to change this. We would not have it so that the average teenager sees 5,000 unhealthy food commercials a year, for example. We would not make it so that there's
5,000.
5,000.
Try 40,000.
40,000 food?
40,000. Wow. Kaiser Family Foundation 2007. 40,000.
Anyway, a lot for sure. but I think that, you know, that reducing the exposure to food cues would be immensely, it would be very, very helpful. I always think of these poor people who smoke and then are on airplanes that have little things that say you can't smoke all over the whole plane. It's like this must be torture for them. But the other thing that we've learned that's worked really well with alcohol and drugs is limiting access is the best way to reduce use and abuse. So we make it so that you have to be a certain age to be able to drink alcohol. We make it so that we tax it, which is also constraining availability because only wealthier people can afford it. We make it so you can only buy alcohol at certain places, not all day long, all over the place. I know San Francisco doesn't have this policy in place, but other places I've lived has had it. So if we could do stuff that limits access, so for example, not having sugar beverages in schools, those are the types of taxing sugar beverages, not having sugar beverages in schools, those are the types of things that would make it a lot easier for 70% of America not to be obese or overweight. So I think those are the policy implications that I can come up with.
Thank you. And Dr. Tarman had a point.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say that to your point that there's tremendous failure with obesity except for bariatric surgery. Well, I would like to make the argument that part of that is because we haven't been thinking about it from an addiction paradigm and consequently using the abstinence model of finding trigger foods. If we're constantly putting the trigger food in front of the person, it's guaranteed to be a failure. And the other piece I wanted to throw in is that what is available today in terms of using an addiction paradigm, because it's not a social service or a medical diagnosis, we're really reliant on the community. And Michael mentioned some of the peer support groups, like OA. There's also FA, Food Addicts and Anonymous. There's actually a whole bunch of smaller groups that are developing 12-step programs. And there's a great amount of support and success there. You go to those people, you'll find that there's a lot of success. People who have actually bought into that program, you'll find a lot more success than you'll find outside in the other types of programs. You just have to know where to look.
Thank you. Dr. Lustig.
Also on the same point, bariatric surgery does work, right? Yeah. Except that one-third gain it back.
Exactly.
And the question is, who's that one-third?
Mm-hmm. And do we not need that part of the stomach that they just clip off?
Yeah. Sort of, yes, no. Complicated. But the bottom line is that it's almost assuredly, as Dr. Eppel mentioned and Dr. Stice mentioned, there are three reasons to eat. Hunger, reward, stress. And presumably every obese person has a defect in one of those three or some combination thereof. And the question is, if you're doing bariatric surgery, what you're doing is you're removing the phenomenon of hunger. That's what you're doing. But if the reason for your obesity was reward or stress, don't expect that it's going to work. And I think that that's part of the reason why we have this recidivism, even amongst the bariatric surgery population. Ultimately, we need better diagnosis. We need some instruments and tools that actually ferret out who's who and direct therapy appropriately. Obviously, not everybody who's obese is food addicted. On the other hand, we're not dealing with the addiction and the people who are.
And Michael,
I wanted to react also to the word on the street that surgery works. The reading I've done is that there is a substantial amount, not only of people who gain their weight back, but people who have complications in surgery, as people do with any kind of surgery, and also that my eating was certainly more than a physical problem. I had a physical problem caused by my overeating, but my overeating was not strictly a physical issue. So having a strictly physical solution was not adequate. And so when I see people, as I did, diet repeatedly and not succeed, it's because they're not addressing the whole problem. And it's only when I took on a broader range of practices and attitudes and treatments that I was able to sustain any kind of recovery. I guess that's all I want to say.
Thank you. Dr. Appel, is food addiction able to be avoided in adults by recognizing patterns and symptoms in youth?
That would be too late. So I'm going to emphasize Eric's point that prevention is pretty much our only hope. And once you start having changes in the brain and some overeating, that's very hard to reverse. And extreme restriction will backfire. And so when you feel, you know, when you try to put kids on a diet and restrict their food environment, then they even want the highly palatable food even more. So that's way too late. Should we go back to, you know, preschool or to babies? That's too late. We need to think about when the brain is being developed in the womb. So we know that the environment in those, that's where we need to start. Mm-hmm. The environment in the womb is one of the major influences on development of the reward circuitry, the stress circuitry, and energy storage sensitivity. So that little fetus is listening to that environment and figuring out, how stressful is my environment going to be? How scarce is our nutrients? And calibrating that brain. So we already know that when pregnant mothers are challenged metabolically, either with trauma, psychological stress, or with poor nutrition or too few calories, that this impairs, it affects how the child reacts both in terms of health and well-being. So in terms of health, those babies come out with they're more thrifty. They know that they're going to be in an environment where they need to store nutrients even better, especially if they come out low birth weight. So they tend to get earlier obesity and adult onset of obesity-related diseases like diabetes and heart disease, and they tend to carry their fat abdominally. So metabolically, we are programming adult disease in the womb, and we now know that's where the adult health starts. Like Rob's book, Obesity Before Birth. In terms of mental health, we also know that that womb environment is calibrating stress sensitivity and stress resilience. So babies come out to be more stress reactive in their cortisol reactivity, for example, as adults if they were exposed to this stress in the womb. And we now know that there's this tight link between stress reactivity and drive for eating palatable food. So we need to think about pregnant women or even women of childbearing age and their physical health, their nutrition, their mental health. At UCSF, one of our big efforts right now is to reduce stress and obesity in pregnant women, and we probably should start even earlier than that before they get pregnant. And, of course, we're following the babies to see if we can prevent the common early weight gain in this group of obese moms. That's common. So what do we do when we see these symptoms in kids? Well, we need to think of both promoting the healthy body and healthy mind in the kids. We want to limit the exposures to all of the toxic food environment and highly palatable food. And pretty much we're in big trouble because you can try to limit it at home and you need to, but then they see it in the schools and their friends having it and they want it even more, and the more you restrict, the more they rebel when they're not under your reign. And so we're pretty much screwed with our kids because we have this food environment, particularly kids who are prone with certain genetic makeups. So what do we do about that? it's really hard to be a parent, even of a child prone to obesity, even in a healthy subculture like the Bay Area. We need to change our social norms. I think that what we control, I'm kind of relying on Kelly Brownell and Rudd Food Policy Center and Rob Lustig to be hammering on the food policy and food environment. What can we do now in our local environments? We can think of our personal food environment, our homes, and our personal social systems, our workplaces, and our schools. Those are the locuses that we can try to control. I personally had experience of telling my social community, let's not, when we dine at each other's houses and we have parties, let's not serve desserts. Let's just serve fruit. And these are all healthy, all well-educated people who know about sugar and the obesity epidemic. And it was that, don't you dare take that away from me. That's your personal choice. Don't try to impose it on us. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of defensiveness because we really want to enjoy our food and our desserts. And so I think that we need to bring in this knowledge that we've heard about today, which shouldn't be so esoteric, and say to our workplace colleagues, we are aware of this, of the power of sugar and the power of food and the weakness of willpower. And it's just a fallacy to leave it to the individual, particularly those who are vulnerable, to be having junk food in the work environment and in the schools. And have, really just change the social norms. So what do we do? What else can we do for our children? Besides controlling the food environment, we can bolster their stress resilience. And we know that addiction often masks depression, low self-esteem, and spikes up during times of stress. So stress vulnerability is a risk factor. So we can think about all of the things in childhood that help promote the stress resilient child. And then we can also think about let me take a step back and just say that at NIH, they are, of course, as frustrated as Rob said, with the data, which shows that there are no effective treatments. And we really need to think out of the box. And one area that is worth really thinking about and exploring for novel treatments is thinking about what we know about the brain systems that control behavior and how we can alter these. So in a simple way, we can think about the prefrontal cortex, which is the home of reflective, analytic thinking and inhibition of behavior. And then we have the more primitive limbic system and hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. And I think one of the best papers on this, written by Rob and colleagues, shows how these systems interact, the stress system, the reward system, and the hunger system. And so in this simple brain model that I want you to think of, it's just two parts of the brain, this prefrontal cortex, the controller, and then our more primitive limbic system. These two systems control behavior by inhibiting each other, right, so that we flexibly can respond and react in emergencies when we need to and eat as much as we can when we get dense calories versus inhibit behavior and plan and do proactive behavior. So these two systems are in balance usually. When we're chronically stressed, we have a chronic imbalance in this prefrontal cortex limbic system. You could think of it as a thinking-feeling imbalance. And that promotes the positive energy imbalance, the overeating and the eating more than we're burning. So what can we do about this imbalance that is kind of chronic in our society? We have an epidemic of stress. We have people who are often working in more of the emotional brain than the thinking brain. How do we damp down reward? We actually don't know how, and maybe it will come down to drugs like methadone. There are certain behaviors like exercise that can damp down reward. But really what we haven't exploited is increasing prefrontal cortex activity, the home of control. We want our decisions about eating to be made thoughtfully and not by our emotional brain. So that is more of an unexplored area of intervention. And I had mentioned that our study is working on mindful training so that people are making decisions thoughtfully and noticing hunger and satiety. There are also a new frontier of studies in behavior that are working on improving executive control through computer programs that improve working memory and attention. So that's a new frontier. It's never been applied to obesity, but it's the same neural systems that control inhibition over eating. So that's one area that might be helpful.
All right, thank you. Now, the next question is, I would like to know, starting with you, Dr. Lustig, what do you think would be an idea that you have for prevention of food addiction? It's very general, I realize, but just something.
Yeah.
Know, yeah.
As I said, we need food. We don't need this food. The food we have today is not, as Michael Pollan says, is not the food your grandparents had. Okay? You know, one of his food rules, don't eat anything that your grandparents wouldn't recognize as food. And there's some truth. I mean, there's real truth to that. Ultimately, all food is inherently good. That's why it's here. It's what we do to the food that's the problem. The process of food processing is problematic. Why? What do they do when they process food? Basically, they do two things. They put the sugar in, they take the fiber out. They put the sugar in for palatability, especially with decreased fat, which we've been dealing with for the last 30 years because the AMA, the AHA, and the USDA told us we had to cut our consumption of fat. And why did they do that? They told us because of heart disease. Well, guess what? We got more heart disease and metabolic syndrome and obesity, and it's breaking the bank. Back when it was only heart disease, it was no big deal. You had a heart attack and you were dead. And you didn't run through all the dollars. Now it's 20, 30, 40 years of disability and chronic medications, and bottom line is there is no medicine. It was the same thing with lung cancer, you know, bottom line. 6 months and you were dead, you know, and sort of the government didn't care. And now we've got, you know, patients that are living a lot longer and chewing up through more money. The bottom line is that sugar is a problem. Sugar is a problem for three different reasons. It's a problem because of this insulin resistance phenomenon. It's a problem because of the aging phenomenon. You know, it's called the Maillard reaction. Anybody who's got diabetes, you know that they measure your hemoglobin A1C. That's glucose attaching to proteins. Well, fructose, the sweet part of sugar, does that seven times faster, causing more reactive oxygen species, more cell damage, and ultimately the aging process advances seven times faster. Basically, you can think of it this way. You can brown your meat in the oven at 375 degrees for an hour, or you can brown your meat at 98.6 degrees for 75 years. You get the same answer when it's done. And what makes both of those reactions go faster? Sugar. That's why we paint the barbecue sauce on the meat to get that nice browning. That's ultimately what happens. And then there's the third problem, which we've been talking about here today, which is that sugar drives increased food consumption. You take a kid, you pre-treat them with a soda, and then you let them loose at the fast food restaurant. Do they eat less or do they eat more? They eat more. You just gave them 150 calories, and they eat more. If our negative feedback energy balance pathway was working properly, they should eat less because they took on 150 calories. They eat more. So you put those three things together, the liver toxicity and insulin resistance, the aging, and the increased consumption, and you've got a real toxic combination. So what do we have? We have substances that are toxic but not abused. Vitamin A, vitamin D, iron. Okay, they're all nutrients too, but in excess, they're toxic. The point is there's no abuse potential, so we don't have to regulate them. Over here we have substances that are abused but not toxic. Caffeine. Nicotine. Nicotine is abused, but not toxic. It's the tars that are toxic that make cigarettes toxic. But you can walk down the street to Walgreens and get Nicorette gum and chew it all you like if you want, and it's over the counter, right? Because nicotine is not toxic. It's abused, but not toxic. So you got substances that are toxic but not abused, abused but not toxic, and it's no big deal. It's when they're toxic and abused together that you got a problem. And we call those cocaine, amphetamine, nicotine, cannabis, ethanol, you know, heroin. You know, bottom line, those are the ones that are regulated. And sugar fits all the criteria for regulation. This was the paper we submitted that was out in Nature earlier this month. And the question is, what are we going to do about this? When 80% of the foods that are in the store today are laced with sugar by the food industry, is this okay? All food is inherently good. It's what we do to the food that's not. By adding sugar and removing fiber. Fiber is the antidote to carbohydrate. Fiber limits the rate of absorption. It also changes your bowel flora so that you're not as efficient at absorbing calories. There are a whole bunch of reasons why fiber is good for you. Problem is, we have none. Our ancestors walking the earth 50,000 years ago used to consume up to 100 grams of fiber a day. We're down to 12. And the food industry did it. And the reason they did it is because of shelf life, because you can't freeze fiber. Go home, take an orange, put it in your freezer overnight, take it out next day, put it on your counter, thaw it, try to eat it, see what you get. What do you get? Mush. Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals form within the plant, damages the cell wall, macerates the cell wall, so that when you thaw it, all the water rushes in, turns it to mush. Food industry knows that. But if you squeeze it and freeze it, it lasts forever. So it's good for your pocketbook, makes the food cheaper. It's good for them, reduces depreciation. It's just not good for your biochemistry. Ultimately, this is a fight between our food environment, our pocketbook, and our biochemistry. That's what this is. And the question is, what are we going to do about it? Which should win? Well, as long as, you know, government's in charge and, you know, the legislative branch keeps passing things like cheeseburger bills, you know, bottom line is we ain't going to get there because our biochemistry is not adapted to this current food environment. The only thing I can see doing, because we can't fix our biochemistry and there's no drug target for this, is changing the environment. And the only way to do that is with policy. And that's why we wrote the paper in Nature.
Okay. So, again, I'd like to leave enough time for some of these questions. But so prevention, to summarize, is, you know, well, more fiber, some policy changes, and regulate sugar. I won't even go there, but that would be ideal, wouldn't it? Michael.
Yeah, a lot of the people in the food industry bang on the principle of personal responsibility. And it confounds, I do not agree with their conception of it, but it confounds them when I say I agree completely. I was not able, I loved what Dr. Tarman said about diagnosis determines treatment. If you have a cough and you think it's just a cough, you'll get a lozenge or some syrup. If you go to the doctor, someone you trust, and he says it's lung cancer, you will then turn, instead of lozenges and syrups, to noxious chemicals injected into your veins and bombardment of radiation. Who would do such a thing unless they were convinced that they had a serious problem? And what happened for me is that I tried to take responsibility for my size by repeatedly dieting, and it never worked. But when I came to understand that I had a more encompassing problem than just a physical problem and that I needed a different set, a more robust set of solutions, I started to change. My life started to change, not only my body size, but many other really happy outcomes as a result of attacking a serious problem with serious medicine. And so I say completely that I took responsibility for my condition once I understood that I had it. So all the people who have dieted repeatedly wanting to do something and failing every time, they may have it too, and they may need a different set of responses. The other part of personal responsibility that I always like to add is that the food manufacturers who know what they're doing, who know that as Dr. Kessler likes to say, Dr. David Kessler likes to say in his book, The End of Overeating, repeated layerings of sugar and salty and fat. They know what's going to sell, and they want to make they want to sell more. So they create things. I would like them to take responsibility as well. They are the ones who are saying it's personal responsibility while rejecting that they have any responsibility. We talk about, to me, it's I understand we're
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I'll stop there then, okay.
Okay, well, to summarize again, personal and corporate responsibility and education. There's a definite education theme here as well. No, Dr. Avina.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Lustig and with Michael. I'll also just add to that, you know, I think prevention is going to be something that it's very environmental, and this is going to come both, you know, from within our family unit mm-hmm. to larger scale societally. Part of the problem is that the norm has changed, and so the norm right now is to be overweight. 66% of the country is overweight. Mm-hmm. So when we look at, you know, ourselves in the group of society, if we're overweight and everyone else is overweight or the majority of the other people are overweight, we feel a sense of belonging. We're part of the norm. And so I think that's part of the problem is we really need to sort of acknowledge that and hopefully change it. And, you know, there is this social psychology associated with mm-hmm. wanting to be a part of the group and feeling the sense of cohesiveness. And so if you look around and see the majority of other people are overweight, you might not feel like something's wrong with you. And so I think that's something that we need to think about when we talk about, you know, how we can evoke policy and evoke education to make people realize that, you know, things need to change and be different.
Yeah. Thank you. Dr. Stice.
I've conducted somewhere like 9 prevention trials for obesity and done meta-analytic reviews of literature, and it's unfortunately true that most prevention programs don't work either. So that's we've tried a lot of things that don't work. Some of the things that have worked is there's sort of a small change intervention, which is sort of like you have people say, okay, what do you eat in a given week? How can you get rid of the least healthy part of your diet? And how can you add in a little bit of exercise? Go do that for a week, come back, and then sort of ratchet it up. That seems to work pretty well. That'll cut the rate of obesity onset by half if you can get kids to do that in 4 1-hour sessions. So that's very promising. We've recently tried adding cognitive dissonance onto this, and we human beings strive to maintain consistency between what we say and what we do. So if you have people say that it's healthy to eat well and bad to eat unhealthy foods and it's good to be lean and not good to be overweight, et cetera, they talk themselves into making healthier decisions. And I think we can capture that. It's inducing hypocrisy to promote health. You can't tell the kids you're doing that because then it doesn't work. But you can make it work better by doing little clever things the social psychologists have figured out, like putting a video camera in the room. So if I give a speech about the cost, the medical costs of obesity, and there's a video camera and I am asked to post it on YouTube, like it really changes my attitudes and behaviors much more. So I think those things can work really well. We're recently playing around with the idea of reappraisals, which was something that came up earlier. Is that, you know, when you're confronted with an array of pastries at Starbucks, for example, what do you think? Do you think, would the cinnamon one taste better than the blueberry one? That is activating all the reward circuitry in a way that you don't want. If you think instead how eating that will shorten my life or how not eating that will really make my health better, you reverse all the abnormal neural response that typically occurs. So I think there's a lot of potential there of just having people train through mass practice how to think and construe food totally differently than instead of, which would taste better in my mouth, which is what we normally do when we're confronted with food. So I think there's a lot of potential interventions that could be easily and simply disseminated. The one thing that really is depressing about the obesity prevention literature is some of the best programs are like 50 hours long that take 2 to 3 years to deliver. And that won't ever be disseminated. So I think we've got to stop trying those sorts of options.
Thank you. I was going to make a summary comment on that, and I've already went out of my head. Shoot. Dr. Appel. Prevention. And right. It's just that, you know, is there one thing that you could think of would be to continue down as far as the prevention model?
Well, I think that I'm still recovering from Eric's comment that the prevention, that no prevention programs that we know of can afford will work. I think that we, you know, the change is going to, you know, the economic forces are against us exponentially, the food industry. And I think we all need to become activists. Mm-hmm. And the thing that changes policy is people and their opinions and their activism. And so I think we need to take personal responsibility. And this is the time. This is the zeitgeist. We have enough science behind us mm-hmm. to speak strongly and confidently and prevent this, you know, intergenerational transmission. So it's the next generation that we can help. We can't necessarily help ourselves who are already obese, but we can stop the cycle.
Wonderful. Dr. Tarman.
Yeah, that's an excellent call to arms. That's great. I just want to reiterate a point that you made earlier about the social norms. I mean, I see people when it is too late, in a sense. But we think about cigarettes and how so many people have quit smoking, and even of the people who have continued to smoke, if you ask them, have you thought about quitting smoking, you find that in the, about two-thirds of them have either thought about, I'm going to do it this year, or they thought about it in the last 6 months or something. So it's on their mind. And it's partly because it's become a social norm now not to, to be a non-smoker. It's become more and more so. In fact, a smoker feels a bit like a pariah now, like I got to go outside and you know, I got smoke breath, I'm sorry. That wasn't an issue 5 years ago, not at all. And if you translate to that, to the food thing, there's a phrase we use in the field that says, every granny is a pusher. I've had people say to me, you're asking me to stop the pasta and the bread? How will I tell my grandmother when I go home and she wants to give me this stuff when I go home to visit family? Because it's a social norm to equate good cooking, notice I say good cooking, with love, et cetera, et cetera. And if we change that norm, which is going to be a long piece of work, but if we do that in the same way that we've done with cigarettes, I think we'll get much more success. So I really like the piece about changing social norms.
Thank you. Let's get it.
On that order, I have to leave, so I'm just going to leave you with one concept, which bangs off what Dr. Tarman just said. Food is not love. Mm. Mm-hmm. It never was, and it never will be. Mm-hmm. Food is pleasure. Love is happiness. Mm. The two are not related. Okay? And I agree. Grandparents are the problem. Let's kill all the grandparents.
And on that note,
I have to go attend
the awards. Thank you very much
for
attending, Dr. Leslie. I have three questions. If I'm I'm going to read these questions first, and again, we'll try to get as many answers because it's for the podcast, so as many people can hear. So, brief answers, please. The first question is: based on what I have heard today, I am a food addict. How do I find medical and psychological help? And this person lives in this area. Does anybody have a recommendation? And again, I'm sorry, we have to be brief in the response.
Well, I do. In my book, Fat Boy, Thin Man, and on the website for the book, I put as many resources as I could find, including nutritionists who, in my opinion, understand food addiction, and they can operate by phone. My nutritionist is in Philadelphia. I live in Boston. Also, all the support groups that I could find that address these issues are also listed in their contact information, their links on the website. And that's what I could do to bring them together.
Thank you. And Michael's book, again, are out front and there as well. Comment on the association of food addiction and sex addiction. And I'm not looking at anyone in particular here, whoever wants to jump in and answer this question. So the association of food addiction and sex addiction. Dr. Charman?
Well, we can give it a go.
Okay.
Well, first of all, both of those would be classified as normal behaviors that can become abnormal. Mm-hmm. I suppose you can not have sex again, but the idea is not to not have sex again, but to have sex within appropriate contexts. You can still apply an abstinence model to sex addiction in the same way that you can with a food addiction. Food addiction, some people, I think actually everybody who's a food addict, no sugar. And similarly with sex addiction, sex is fine, but porn is not. Sex outside, you may have to designate your own rules. In other words, find your trigger behaviors. Sex outside of a partnership is not. And then apply it in the same way.
Okay, thank you. And this is the last question that I have been given to ask. And then after that, Dr. Bill Grant is there next to the mic, and you can get in line and ask your questions. And we'll, again, the same, a fairly quick question, a fairly quick answer, I'm sorry. What is the research on the addictive potential of carbohydrates like pasta? research on the addictive potential of carbs. Anybody want to take that one? Michael, you already mentioned don't take my forks.
Basically, carbohydrates are just simple sugars, so I think all that we've heard about sugars applies directly to simple carbohydrates. So, yeah, they're highly addictive. I still would vilify fat more than simple sugars myself, but mm-hmm. I would put simple sugars as the second worst in terms of addictive foods.
Okay.
I think we can also think about the insulin resistance to brain mm-hmm. direct feedback. So when you eat a lot of simple carbs, you become more insulin resistant, and as Rob described, your reward center can become insulin and leptin resistant, so you don't get satiety. So it's kind of a positive feed-forward cycle mm-hmm. when you're on a high-carb diet.
Thank you.
And genotype also interacts with that, I think. So carbs for some people are very dangerous, okay. and for others not.
And just to make that very simple, if you just pull out the glycemic index book, it'll tell you what starches are closer to sugar than not, and you just follow that. That's going to be very useful.
Mm-hmm. But since you brought that up, a Snickers bar is lower on the glycemic index than a baked potato. That doesn't necessarily mean it's better for you. So you have to take the glycemic index with a little bit of a grain of salt have a little
bit
of sugar. And sugar. That's a good point. Good point. Go ahead and ask your question. Thank you.
I have a question in terms of online communities for food addiction. So I work for MedHelp, which is the largest online health community and mobile platform company. We have people coming into our community for interest addiction to drugs and going through rehab. I'm just wondering, what do you think people could do in terms of food addiction, offering support in terms of an online platform? What are the trigger points that they could help in terms of inhibiting or in terms of emotional support or other ways that online support groups could really help in terms of food addiction?
Okay, thank you.
I think each person's experience is going to be different. But what I would say from knowing lots of food addicts is that compared to other addicts, we are more among the best isolators. And showing up and being accountable for my actions is one of the things that makes it sustains my recovery. And I find that I'm speaking only for myself here. Each person's experience will be different. That when I show up in online, I'm not showing up quite as much. And that includes a very real practical matter. If I'm gaining weight and I show up in person, people can see that. If I show up online and I'm gaining weight, people can, and they depend on my saying that I'm gaining weight. And sometimes I'm willing to do that, but sometimes I'm not. And so I think, there are lots of people who cannot find more robust mutual support systems, and online is better than nothing. But I would put them in a hierarchy where they're maybe not as effective for all people.
Thank you. Okay. Next question, please.
Hi. I also work in the mental health field and have seen patients who are on one medication and it's not working and they get switched, and that medication causes them to gain literally 30, 40, 50 pounds within a short period of time, take them off and they lose it. Also along that same vein is in talking with my mother, who's 87, talking about the combinations of like always eating something with vinegar, with something with fat, and various things that were done a century ago. And I guess the overall question is what other... it seems other kinds of brain chemistry is happening that is causing the weight gain in the mental health patients who are not changing their eating habit, and the other kinds of things that people used to do that seem to moderate fats better.
Thank you for that question. Who'd like to answer that one?
I'm not really sure what the question is.
Yeah. Brain chemistry are happening? That how can a person gain 60 pounds with a psychotropic medication and they aren't changing their habits? And how did people a century ago moderate weight a little better with things like the balance of vinegar and fats and various things like that?
Well, I'll tackle the former question. I can't help with the second one. But most of the medications that have weight gain as a side effect either affect the dopaminergic or the opioid systems, and they usually do affect caloric intake, even though that might not be reported. This is one of the things is what people report eating is not always accurate. And in fact, there is there's something called doubly labeled water that uses oxygen isotopes to measure oxygen utilization very precisely. And you can basically tell what somebody ate, plus or minus a roast beef sandwich over a two-week period. And the people who say, I can't, no matter how much I cut down my eating, I never lose weight, are admitting to only half of the food that they're swallowing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So don't, you know, take everything with a grain of salt in terms of the self-report thing. It usually, there is, you know, it's usually causing hyperphagia or, you know, overeating more because of its altering reward circuitry.
Yeah, we see that underestimating with the drugs and alcohol all the time. I mean, when I do a history with somebody and they tell me I only drink six beer a day, I'm taught to double that. Mm-hmm. The person will underestimate. But I do know that with some of the drugs, they also change the lipid profile so that there's probably a hormonal endocrine basis as well as on top of the reward pathway as well with some of the drugs, with the antidepressants and particularly the antipsychotics like Seroquel and those drugs. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Next question, please.
Okay, it was said not all obese people are food addicted. So is it true that not all food addicted people are obese? Right. And my question is, besides obesity, are there other problems with being a food addict? And is your body affected in other ways, although you don't appear to be obese? Wow.
Thank you. That's a good question.
Yeah, I can take this. I think, certainly, you know, we've been talking about food addiction within the context of obesity because that seems to be sort of the global problem that we're all interested in. But I do think there are aspects of food addiction that can be seen in other eating disorders. There's been some discussion of, you know, even the opposite of obesity. Anorexia might have aspects of addiction related to it in terms of, you know, opioid systems. Also, eating disorders such as bulimia or binge eating disorder in which patients aren't necessarily obese or overweight even. They could be normal weight, but still be having a maladaptive attachment to food. I think that's really the underlying theme is people who have a poor association with the types of foods they're eating, and they're eating for reasons other than caloric need.
Mm-hmm. And I have an observation to add to that. Marin and I, for the last year, have been trying to recruit people with food addiction for our studies, and we found that going to the food addiction groups and societies is not a very good way because those people have often recognize that they have an addiction and have treated it, and so they are not overweight, or at least they're not obese. And so they still live with addiction as a chronic problem to manage, but they don't have the excessive caloric intake. But I think that there are other things that go along with it, preoccupation and drive and cravings that they're managing all the time, so these ongoing support groups are still important.
And I also want to say that you can have diabetes and be skinny if you're eating a really high glycemic load diet. I mean, you can screw up your body and not be obese at all with things that we associate with obesity. So, yeah, there's lots of problems.
If I can just add, because that's such a good question. I for sure, you can be skinny and be a food addict. And you know, what are the problems besides obesity? Well, mood, depression, anxiety, self-loathing. I mean, what is the definition of a food addict out there in the real world? You know, it's things like, you know, do you binge purge? Do you eat in secret? Do you steal other people's food? Do you try to stop and you can't and you hate yourself? I mean, living with that is... that's not obesity, but that is still, that's a mindset that's very unhealthy.
Thank you. Next question, please.
I'm a psychologist, and I work with people with anorexia and bulimia, and there's definitely a different model of moderation, and it's really, yes, you know, psychological roots and in your childhood. And I'm wondering if you would talk about, again, biochemical differences, and do you think the problems really lie there and they're not psychological, are the same kind of problems going on, just, you know, sugar consumption, fat consumption that are screwing up people's eating habits, that that's more the priority than maybe psychological issues?
Well, I am the least clinical person up here, of course, and I always like to acknowledge that that's the truth, but we're so caught up in either-or question. My experience is that I had psychological issues that led me to eat, and I had biochemical issues that led me to eat, and they have different solutions, and they have different severity, and someone can be both, you know, both a psychological eater and a biochemical eater, and I mean that beyond just needing calories to survive.
I was just going to say, I think this came up earlier with Alyssa, was talking about how for an anorexia nervosa patient, the not eating is their goal state. That's what they're pursuing. And that becomes, I mean, your reward circuitry can get you excited about mountain biking, sports cars, whatever, I mean, that you get excited about. And if it's leanness and not ever eating and showing that you have more willpower than everybody else, that's the reward circuitry is involved in that. So I think it's just plugged into that goal, not the goal of hedonic pleasure from swallowing something. So I think there's some similarities in that regard.
Thank you.
I just want to throw in one little piece with food addiction versus eating disorder, that there may well be three or four different distinct entities. But I'm wondering, of the crowd, even of the anorexics, but certainly for the bulimics and binge eating disorders, how much there might be a misdiagnosis and the fact that those people are suffering from a food addiction that's just been misdiagnosed because we're not allowed to use that word yet.
Good points. Thank you. Last question.
I just want to thank you all for this really fascinating program, and I wish I'd been able to listen to you all a few months back when I was still on deadline for my next book, which is to help people to deal with sugar addiction. It's called Beyond Sugar Shock. Anyhow, can each of you name one favorite tactic that you think somebody who is a sugar addict can use? I mean, this talk about prevention is great, but the fact of the matter is we've got, 60% of the population who need help now. So, like things like, meditation, Zumba, whatever. What would be one tactic? Seriously, I know people who've lost weight by doing Zumba and meditating.
Well, I'm repeating myself now, but my what worked for me was abstinence. When I stopped putting the substance into my body that was causing me trouble, I stopped having that kind of trouble. I read labels of the things that I eat, and if sugar is on the list 5 or higher, I don't eat it. And I still eat a very broad, very satisfying diet. And there's no way you know or anyone knows if sugar is a problem until they stop putting it in their bodies and see what happens.
Quickly, I want to say you are not alone. To own up to the diagnosis, find out that you're not alone and that there is a help out there. And we can't do that until we actually identify ourselves as food addicts.
Okay.
I can comment on the meditation.
Oh, okay.
Since you brought up meditation, I do think it's absolutely worth trying. It will help some people. And it will promote a cognitive shift toward acceptance of negative feelings and away from seeking pleasure, which is always ephemeral, toward more of these kind of positive states of contentment and noticing an awareness of other joys and positive ways to experience life. And, of course, it dampens down the stress arousal system, so it's going to be helpful for that shift from the toward a more PFC limbic balance where you have more of the thinking than emotional brain dominating and ruling your life.
Thanks, Dr. Pill. Okay, we have time. Do you have one another question? Okay, one more question, then we have 1 minute.
This is personal. How can I, as a mother of an obese, 300-pound, 30-year-old daughter, provide encouragement to start losing weight without her feeling I don't love her as she is?
I hear you. And it is not an easy solution. What I can say, speaking strictly from my own experience, is that no matter how much other people in my life wanted me to be better, until I could get in a place where I wanted to be better enough to just try one different strategy, then people could harangue me all they wanted. I didn't want to hear it. Leave me alone. But when I wanted help, then the key is to know what you want to say at that moment of weakness, because that moment may not come again for a while. That was my experience.
How about I love you and I want you to be healthy? And it's not the fact that you're obese and I don't love you. It's that the obesity is a sign of your ill health. I'm talking about health right now. So it's basically that. It's focusing on the health aspect of it. One of the things we say in the addiction field, too, in this area is obesity is we wear our addiction through obesity. So it's just a symptom of the problem. And, I love you and I want to help you with the problem. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we're just about out of time. So in closing, Well, we'd very much like to thank all our panelists here today, Mr. Michael Prager, Dr. Nicole Avina, Dr. Eric Steis, Dr. Vera Tarman, Dr. Alyssa Appel, and Dr. Robert Lustig for their comments here today. We also like to thank our audiences here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 109th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thank you all. There's